Thursday, October 11th, 2007, meeting of the House and Senate Interim Judiciary Committees at 1 p.m. at the Governor Hotel in Portland, Oregon.
I'll call to order a meeting of the House Judiciary Interim House Judiciary Committee for Thursday, October the 11th, 2007, and we'll postpone the calling to order of the Senate Committee because it's lacking a quorum as yet. Senator, did you want to convene a committee?
Yes, point of presentation. What we're going to do with the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee, we're going to go and start as a subcommittee. Since only two of our members are here currently, we are expecting two others to be here any time, but instead of holding up the proceeding, we'll start meeting as a subcommittee, and once we have a quorum, then we'll go ahead and go to the organizational part of the meeting that's necessary. So, Chair McPherson, if you want to go ahead and do yours and take care of that.
We will proceed through the organizational meeting portion of the House Committee, starting off with an introduction of committee members and staff. And I think what we'll do is just self-introductions and start with Representative Shields over at that end, since we're pretty well known to each other, but maybe not as well known to all the people in the room. Just a brief description of who you are and where you're represented would be helpful.
Chip Shields, District 43, from the Northeast Portland.
Lane Forrest. House District 51,
Clackamas,
and a little
of the Pennsylvania. Representative Kevin Cameron, South Salem, Baldwinsville, Turner, and C. Representative Shields and Phil Griffiths from
I'm Representative Suzanne Bonamici, House District 34 in Washington County.
Jeff Barker, House District 28 in Washington.
And I'm Representative Greg McPherson, Chair of the Interim Judiciary Committee. I represent House District 38, which is Lake Oswego and part of Southwest Portland. And we have two House Committee members who could not be here today because they're attending an NCSL meeting in Denver, and that's Representative Betty Comp and Vice Chair of the Committee, Gene Wisnett, and Jeff Barker is the other Vice Chair for the House Judiciary Committee in this interim.
And the Senate is going to go ahead and call into order the Interim Committee on Judiciary. We now have our quorum. And what I'm going to also ask is our members, and we also have some guest members of the Senate who are sitting in with us and will be presenting during our meeting. But if Senator Morris, since you're on that end, if you'll just go ahead and identify yourself before you come back into it.
Thank you, Frank Miller, State Senator, District 8, calling for about 30
I'm Doug Whitsett, representing District 28 in five counties in Southern Oregon.
Vicki Walker, representing Eugene and Junction City, the northern half of Eugene. District Senator Pazoski represents the southern half and Junction City. And I'll be leaving a little bit early today because I start my motorcycle training class tonight in Eugene.
I'm Bill Taylor, I'm Council Committee.
And I'm Floyd Brzezinski, as I said, State Senator. My district includes parts of Lane and Douglas County, and I want to welcome all of my members that are here. Senator Burdick is on her way, from my understanding, and I believe Senator Byer was not able to join us today. So,
Council, we do have actually another office manager here.
Yeah.
Who runs the show.
And then also, Jennifer is in the back, and she's no longer with us. Well, another one, good one, has been stolen away. So hopefully you'll get on a good time. You'll be back with us. All right. So with that, we need to go through the formalities, I guess, of adoption of the rules for the Senate as well as I think the House.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just
and if I could,
members should have a copy of the rules before them. Believe me, something else earlier also.
And you're staffing today, Rules Committee?
That's correct.
So you're going to give us a dual rules for interpretation and guidance?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Committee, if need be, I shall. They are rules that are put together by the respective chambers or similar to all committees. Much like I would go through the section by section, that's pretty good.
I think we've covered enough of the record. If I can. Chair McPherson, I'll go ahead and take a motion from the Senate.
Chair, I move the adoption of the proposed committee rules.
Senator Walker has moved for the adoption of the proposed Senate rules for the interim committee for 2007-2008. Is there any discussion? Any objection? If so, what?
Mr. Chair, I move that the Constitution Committee.
Representative Barker moves that the House Interim Committee adopt the rule that you have before you for the interim 2007-2008. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, the motion passes and the rule is adopted.
Mr. Chair, right before we get started, I'm going to let you take us down that path. Senator Burdick is here. I'm going to have her, if she would just take a moment to identify herself and welcome us to her district.
Yes, thank you. I'm Jeannie Burdick. This is my district where I have a milk used to be and I'm the outgoing chair of judiciary, and I'm very excited that Senator Zinski is coming in as chair.
And I should have mentioned earlier that Representative Wayne Krieger is also a member of the Interim Judiciary Committee and is expected. He did have a commitment in district in the South Coast, and when your district is as far away from Portland as his is, it's a bit of a trek to get here, and I'm sure he's on the road and will be joining us when he arrives. With that, we'll move on to the next item on our agenda, which is an informational meeting on Measure 40, dealing with property offenders and drug offenders. From that informational meeting, we have this as indicated in the notice of the meeting, is limited to invited testimony, and we're going to begin with a presentation from Kevin Mannix, the chief sponsor of the meeting.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, vice chairs, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Mannix, and I'm an attorney. I'm from Salem. I'm a former member of the Legislative Assembly, having served 5 terms in the House and a partial term in the Senate. I apologize for my voice today, but I had throat surgery a week ago, and I still have stitches in the back of my throat, so I have to sort of whisper. But I can speak. Since about half the members of this committee have not served with me in the legislature, I'll give you a brief background sketch as to my career, and especially as it affects criminal law. I've been an attorney for 33 years in active practice, and during my first 8 years, I was in government service, including service as an Assistant Attorney General for Oregon and as an Assistant Attorney General for the U.S. Territory of Guam, as well as 3 years as an Administrative Law Judge for the State of Oregon. For the last 22 years, I've been in private practice, and my private practice does not include criminal law. It's on the civil side. It's in the past largely involved administrative law and civil litigation. My involvement in the criminal justice field really began when I was an Assistant Attorney General for Oregon, because in the appellate division, about half my caseload involved criminal cases. And I was introduced to the vagaries of the criminal justice system, both in terms of constitutional but as well as statutory interpretation. After that, in Guam, I did a little bit of criminal work, but almost all my work was civil. My second introduction to the criminal justice system occurred as a candidate for the legislature in 1988, and then during my service as a legislator, where I found that criminal justice reform, the public safety system, does not have the same well-organized support network out there that many other elements of public policy do have. We've got a good support network in terms of health care delivery. We've got a good support network in terms of K-12 education, higher education, and I think very wonderful advocates for local government. We do have organizations that are involved in public safety issues, but there is not the same organized cohort that comes to the legislature to deal with those issues. It's more on a hit or miss basis. I mention this because during my experience as a legislator, I was pleased to be the chief sponsor of more successful criminal justice reform legislation than any other legislator in Oregon, over 60 bills, including the murder by abuse statute, the anti-stalking law, the identity theft law, the mail theft law, and a number of other laws that the legislature passed. But in my experience in working with the Legislative Assembly, I found that absent that organized cohort that could come in and really pressure for massive change, major changes in the criminal justice system would often have to come at the hands of another unorganized cohort, which is the voters. And in 1994, I did go to the voters with three ballot measures, 10, 11, and 17, which passed overwhelmingly. And I did that only after having found that the legislative process was not willing to offer the solutions that many of us and the voters clearly thought were necessary. This involved prison work, and it involved mandatory minimum sentences for violent crimes. It also involved pushing for a reform of the juvenile justice system that saying certain violent juveniles would be tried in adult court, although they would be incarcerated in the juvenile justice system. And at the time, the reforms of Senate Bill 1 were put together during the discussion of Measure 11. And in the 1995 session, we saw a massive, very positive reformation of the juvenile justice system, including the establishment of the Oregon Youth Authority. And then Attorney General Ted Kulongoski was instrumental in much of that work. I was on the committee that pushed out that legislation. Where we are today is there are two initiative petitions, which I'm one of the chief petitioners, which have not just been presented to the voters for signatures, but for which signatures have already been filed with the Secretary of State. I know that Initiative Petition 40 is the subject of discussion today, but there is a companion measure, 41, which I think is equally significant. I'll only discuss it parenthetically since it's not on your full agenda, but I do think it bears discussion. Initiative Petition 40 is a response to the sentencing structure in the state dealing with so-called property crimes. I say so-called property crimes because I cannot imagine, other than perhaps a sex crime, a crime which is more personal than identity theft. I cannot imagine the impact of the non-property crimes called drug dealing. Class A felony, Class B felony drug dealing, where predators are out there in the community pushing meth, heroin, cocaine, and other hard drugs in our society. And in dealing with those kinds of issues, it is necessary that there be a holistic response. In my work as a legislator, I was continually supporting improvement in mental health services, improvement in rehabilitation programs, prevention programs, Healthy Start, Head Start, work with kids at risk, work with juveniles who were troubled. All of these things are absolutely necessary components in the criminal justice system. And yes, most offenders who are incarcerated will be returned to the community. We need transition programs. We need job placement programs. And yes, the prison work program called for training, education and training for inmates. And I mention all of this because it's too easy to look at a particular ballot measure as a narrow piece and not understand it in the context of all the things we are attempting to do to reform criminal justice. What is the objective? The objective is to make Oregon one of the best states in the nation in terms of its public safety system. Not a police state, but a public safety system where citizens feel safe in their neighborhoods and their communities, where they feel that they can go to school and engage in work and associate with other people without having to be fearful, and knowing that there's a justice system that will respond and be respectful of victims. And I say this as the chief sponsor of the Victims' Rights Amendments to the Oregon Constitution, which I think are so important to understanding how all of this fits together. And I don't want to be in a preaching mode, but I'm in a very aggressive mode because I think that The methodology used by the legislature in addressing public safety issues does not allow the House and Senate Judiciary Committees the full power that they really need to bring about major change in public policy. Why? Because almost anything you do that has any substance has to go to Ways and Means. And if it goes to Ways and Means, a great deal of it will never come out again with the funding. And I understand that the Ways and Means Committee is the methodology for making those tough judgments about prioritization with money. But as I mentioned before, you don't have the same cohort who are able to exert the political pressure to push public safety as the same kind of priority that I think the voters have got and which they want the legislature to respect. And I'll give you one example. In the 1999 session, Senator Prusansky was vice chair of our Judiciary Committee. We pushed out a lot of good legislation. We continually had to worry, though, about the budget impact. That's proper. I was on another committee where we dealt with the question of compensating jurors for their service. And we ended up passing out a bill that said after 3 days of service, jurors will be paid $50 a day instead of, I believe, $10 a day, because we wanted to reduce the impact on good citizens serving on juries, and we wanted to encourage good people to be willing to serve. We put a delayed effective date on it of July 1, 2001, so it would not have to go to Ways and Means, because we'd already been told it would die in Ways and Means. It passed. It was signed into law. Then I left the legislature. And in the 2001 session, the princes of Ways and Means got retribution. They repealed the law before it went into effect. Now, I use it as a small example of how the process can squelch good public policy because there is not enough of a cohort within the legislative process, in my opinion, to advocate for public safety and the policies that we need. And, of course, we may disagree about that. Now, we have Initiative Petition 40. It requires about 82,000 verified signatures to get on the ballot. We have filed 149,000 signatures. I'm confident that there will be enough signatures verified that it will be on the ballot in November 2008. Initiative Petition 41 is a constitutional amendment which dedicates 15% of lottery revenues to public safety. Since it's a constitutional amendment, it requires over 110,000 signatures that are verified to get on the ballot. We filed almost 164,000 signatures with the Secretary of State. I'm confident that Petition 41 will also be on the ballot November 4, 2008. 41 deals with one question that comes up routinely, which is, well, what about some dedicated funding for whatever? 41 dedicates half. Of the money to fully fund the forensics and criminal investigation operations of the state police. And I know there will be a backfill. All the general fund dollars will be pulled out. So when I say fully fund, I mean the lottery revenues will fully take care of those operations, and the money currently used out of general fund for those can be used for other purposes. That's half. That means we can have what I call CSI Oregon. We can have an aggressive program of investigation, both for the sake of the victims and for the sake of the alleged predators and perpetrators, to make sure that they truly get justice, prompt and full DNA testing, prompt and full forensics, etc. The second half of Petition 41, the second half of the money from Petition 41 goes to counties. A large chunk of that goes to prevention programs for young children at risk. Another chunk goes to help with prosecutors, and another chunk goes to sheriffs for field operations, not to fund their jails. That is out there to provide some resources at the local level to allow local government to work with state government through the criminal investigation process to be able to implement 40 effectively. And what is 40? It's a system of mandatory minimum sentences for certain identified crimes. But it is not a simplistic system. It is a carefully crafted system. And it speaks for itself. I'm sure you have copies. If you don't, I brought in a set which I think have been distributed to the committee. It's a one-page initiative. And it starts out by saying, if you're a Class A or Class B felon drug dealer, you're going to prison for 3 years. Those of us who saw the Crystal Darkness program Tuesday night at 7:30 on most television stations understand the dramatic negative impact that the methamphetamine epidemic has had in this state. Well, one way to deal with that is to pull the predators off the streets. You notice we don't deal with possession here. We deal with dealers, Class A and B felons. And actually, I overstated a little bit because we've got 36 months in Part A. That's 3 years and 30 months in Part B. For identity theft, there's a mandatory minimum sentence of 3 years. We need to send a message to the world that identity theft is not acceptable, that it's reprehensible conduct, that is a major personal violation. And while it is not as serious as perhaps physical assault or rape, it is certainly much more serious than burglary or auto theft and will be treated as such. I know the legislature last session passed an aggravated identity theft bill that says if you steal 5 identities, you'll get a presumptive sentence of, I believe, 14 months. Thank you for that. That's a step in the right direction. But why do we wait till someone's destroyed 5 people's lives to pull them out of circulation? This says you destroy one person's identity, you will be put out of circulation for 3 years. Now, we move down, and I'll try to speed this up because you may want to have time for questions, and I certainly would enjoy that interchange. There's more to this in terms of some of the, I'll call them lesser offenses, the burglary in the second degree, theft in the first degree, and the like. You'll notice that we say where the person has a serious criminal record. For some of these lesser crimes, we're going to require that someone have 2 prior misdemeanors or 1 prior felony before they get into the mandatory minimum connection or accountability. In a couple of other elements, I think it's important to note that we've tried to provide for flexibility. If you've got a 17-year-old who steals a neighbor's car but didn't really steal it, let's say they went for a joyride, right now under the current statute, unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, you've got a pretty wide range of options. We didn't touch that. Instead, we created a new theft statute, motor vehicle theft, and provided for a mandatory minimum sentence if you have a serious criminal record for motor vehicle theft. So we tried to be careful about not having unintended consequences for some youthful, as I've heard people say, indiscretion. There's flexibility built in there. In addition, we were careful about the cost of pretrial incarceration, knowing that in some of these circumstances, with mandatory minimum sentences pending, the judges may find it more necessary to pretrial incarcerate someone, and we provided that the state should fully reimburse the county for the cost of pretrial incarceration. And that's to make sure that there's no added cost to the counties. You notice when I talked about 41, there was no money there for county jails. In 40, we say, in effect, the state and its general fund will have to take care of that obligation. Now, I do not assert to you that Petition 40 is a panacea and that this is the one-size-fits-all, end-all, end-game in public safety. But I do assert to you that this is a serious effort to change the paradigm as to public safety in the state for the next tier of offenses. Having dealt with the violent crime offenses, which went down 44% in the first 10 years that Measure 11 was in effect, and looking at where we are with burglary and auto theft and identity theft and drug dealing, this allows us to take aggressive action as to additional predators. But finally, note that unlike Measure 11, which said that the perpetrators had to be kept in secure facilities, we specifically talk about state prison facilities and work camps. The idea is that you may have some offenders here who would be in the custody of the Department of Corrections who could be in what I'll call an equivalent to work release programs. They can be dynamically kept under control, and there will be a much broader range of discretion about how the custodial incarceration is handled, unlike Measure 11, where we said, these are dangerous guys. They've got to be kept in very secure facilities. So there is a difference there, too. So while I've for the media, 15-second soundbite sometimes referred to this as son of 11. This is actually great-great-grandson of 11. It's not nearly as close to 11 as it might appear at first glance. There's some nuances that have been built into this. And I will tell you, too, quite straightforwardly, these nuances were built in based on our experience with Measure 11. Measure 11 was modified three times with my agreement and the agreement of many other people who had supported Measure 11 by the legislature. Now, because of Measure 10, it takes a two-thirds vote of the House and the Senate to do that, but it was done three times because of our experience and our desire to make sure that we smoothed out the edges. That experience has now been applied in the crafting of Petition 40. I thank you for the opportunity to appear here today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mannix.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Mannix, for being here. I think you did a great job for somebody with stitches in your throat. You mentioned something about after Measure 11 crime going down. I read something, I think it was just in the paper recently, could have been FBI statistics, about property crimes decreasing significantly. I think it was about 16% in Oregon on top of 5% decrease last year. And I wonder if you have factored that into your consideration in bringing this measure forward.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici. Yes. We have a number of missions when it comes to public safety, and we should be very pleased that in the last year we've seen progress in terms of the property crime rates in Oregon. That's a good thing to see. This isn't just about crime rates, although the mission is a safer community. It's also about accountability. Accountability for the impact on the victim, accountability in terms of validating the sanctions that a society wants to apply for crime. So in an absolute sense, we need real sanctions for predators in order to hold them accountable. But in a relative sense, we've seen a positive blip, but for many years, we've actually had chronically high property crime. For the 3 years preceding 2006, we had the third worst property crime in the United States and the fourth worst property crime rate in the United States and the fourth worst property crime rate in the United States. A scandal. And I did not see a lot of attention based on those kinds of statistics to the issue. Now we've seen some progress, and I think it has to do with a number of things. Drug courts, which the legislature has been willing to expand, are an important component. Drug rehabilitation. We do know that a lot of these crimes are intermingled with drug addiction, and there's a tremendous impact of that. And so we are doing some things that are good that will help drive down that crime rate. But at the same time, we also need to have the tool available to hold the predator ultimately accountable and pull that person out of circulation, which is what Petition 40 provides.
The Senator has a question for us.
You mentioned the public support for public safety and indicated there's kind of a disconnect between the legislative ways and means process, which tends to favor the other programs, and the but you say that the public is wildly supportive of the public safety. I think the polling would probably back you up. But given that, why did you not include a funding mechanism in this measure, a tax increase or something that will keep, that will prevent this program from taking money from the other programs like education and health care and the other things that government does?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, that's a very fair question. I think the short answer is because this is a general fund responsibility. This is something that should be handled out of the general fund, and we saw $2 billion in additional resources this session, this last regular session, and a relatively small portion of that was used to enhance public safety. So I'm back to saying this should be a general fund project. Now, do provide some backup support on the other side. I've seen the success that we've had with our state parks, where we finally provided state parks. Everybody loves parks, but somehow since the 1940s we hadn't done much about it. The great folks who put together that 15% of the lottery profits for parks and fish and wildlife, we've seen a real turnaround in what the state's able to do on parks. And so With 41, we are providing some additional funding to help the prosecutors, to help the sheriffs, and to help the counties with their commission in children and families and prevention programs, all of which will tie in. But then in terms of the incarceration costs, that's always been a general fund obligation. I'll be the first to stand in line to help us look at prison costs in the states, which are very high, and how we might do things to reduce those costs. But I can't put everything in one ballot measure.
Go ahead.
Well, I would dispute this notion that the legislature has not funded public safety. Before Measure 11 passed, higher ed outspent corrections, and now it's vice versa. And we have been on a major prison building initiative since Measure 11 passed, and, you know, because incarceration is the most expensive form of public safety. And when you talk about Measure 41, that money comes out of education and parks. I mean, if you take it out of the lottery, 15% from the lottery, then that's money that's not available for education and parks. So it's the same issue. You know, why wouldn't you put, given the public support for this, why would you not put a tax increase, a straightforward tax increase on this measure?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, let me give you an analogy. When it comes to K-12 education, we don't go into each session having debate about whether or not we should stop educating kids in the 9th grade or the 10th grade or the 11th grade or the 12th grade. We all agree that we ought to be properly funding K-12 education. That's our obligation. And it's not let's make a deal about how short can we make it. Because we understand that's the challenge and how best can we accommodate that challenge. But when it comes to public safety, back in 1989, the mechanism was set up to say, well, we'll just keep having a relative public safety standard based on resources, and I disagree with that. Now, in terms of funding mechanisms, I mentioned that we need to have the tool available to hold the predator ultimately accountable and pull that person out of circulation, which is what Petition 40 provides.
You mentioned the public support for public safety and indicate there's kind of a disconnect between the legislative waste cleanup process, which tends to favor the other programs, and the public is wildly supportive of the public safety. I think Paul would probably back you up. But given that, why did you not include a funding mechanism in this measure, a tax increase or something that will keep, that will prevent this program from taking money from the other programs like education and health care and the other things the government does?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, that's a very fair question. I think the short answer is because this is a general fund responsibility. This is something that should be handled out of the general fund, and we saw $2 billion in additional resources this session, this last regular session, and a relatively small portion of that was used to enhance public safety. So I'm back to saying this should be a general fund project. Now, do provide some backup support on the other side. I've seen the success that we've had with our state parks, where we finally provided state parks. Everybody loves parks, but somehow since the 1940s we hadn't done much about it. The great folks who put together that 15% of the lottery profits for parks and fish and wildlife, we've seen a real turnaround in what the state's able to do on parks. And so with 41, we are providing some additional funding to help the prosecutors, to help the sheriffs, and to help the counties with their commission in children and families and prevention programs, all of which will tie in. But then in terms of the incarceration costs, that's always been a general fund obligation. I'll be the first to stand in line to help us look at prison costs in the states, which are very high, and how we might do things to reduce those costs. But I can't put everything in one ballot measure.
Well, I would dispute this notion that the legislature is not funded public safety. Before Measure 11 passed, higher ed outspent corrections, and now it's vice versa. And we've been on a major prison building initiative since Measure 11 passed, and, you know, because incarceration is the most expensive form of public safety. And when you talk about Measure 41, that money comes out of education and parks. If you take it out of the lottery, 50% of the lottery, then that's money that's not available for education and parks. So it's the same issue. Why wouldn't you put, given the public support for this, why would you not put a tax increase, a straightforward tax increase on the
well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, let me give you an analogy. When it comes to K through 12 education, we don't go into each session having debate about whether or not we should stop educating kids in the 9th grade or the 10th grade or the 11th grade or the 12th grade. We all agree that we ought to be properly funding K through 12 education. That's our obligation, and it's not let's make a deal about how short can we make it, because we understand that's the challenge and how best can we accommodate that challenge. But when it comes to public safety, back in 1989, the mechanism was set up to say, well, we'll just keep having a relative public safety standard based on resources, and I disagree with that. Now, in terms of funding mechanisms, I mentioned the $2 billion in additional funds that were available this past session. I'd also mention, on the lottery, the last four biennia, the lottery profits have increased 23% each biennium. And why is that important? Because I thought about existing programs that are funded by the lottery, they will not be displaced as to their existing dollars under 41. 41 may take up 15 of the 23% increase in that's coming down the pike. In fact, it may be 26 or 30% increase. But there'll still be additional dollars for things that are currently funded by the lottery, but there also will be a place to help with some important programs at the county level as well as at the state level. I add very quickly that in terms of this whole debate, when I look at the sentencing structure here, I'd love to go out and ask a citizen, so what do you think ought to happen when someone who's had a prior felony conviction or two prior misdemeanor convictions takes your car? Should they get probation? I don't think so. 14 months, that sounds pretty good. In terms of an accountability system and justice, citizens want to see that, and they expect it to be funded out of the general fund.
Mr. Maxwell, not get distracted with the Measure 41 discussion, which is lottery funds. What you said is that Measure 40 should be paid for out of the general fund.
Yes.
And I've been reading ahead here in the material that's going to be presented a little bit later to us, and I see a range of projected cost of $250 million to $400 million per biennium. Do you dispute that cost projection?
Mr. Chairman, yes and no. The cost projection is an honest effort by those who put the projection together, and in that sense I won't dispute it because they're looking at the figures and doing what they can do. They have a real hard time trying to anticipate prosecution tactics and sentencing practices that will occur. Measure 11 was, the anticipated costs of Measure 11 were twice as high as the actual ultimate cost. And at that time I said, everyone's acting like these folks are virgin criminals, they've never been dealt with by the system before. In terms of this one, let's assume for purposes of discussion that the $400 million figure is correct per biennium. I'd say let's embrace that figure. That's 20% of the increase in the general fund money that was available this biennium. That's not a bad shot towards enhancing public safety.
Ms. Maddox, the other things the general fund supports are things like education, health care, and state police. So are you saying that you would prefer to spend $400 million less on education or health care or state police in order to fund this measure because you haven't provided any other funding source?
Mr. Chairman, why am I smiling? That's a catch-22 question. I don't want to spend less on anything. And every good politician wants to spend more on everything, but of course nobody wants to raise taxes anymore. If we want to have a discussion about the tax structure, the whole tax structure of the state needs to be completely revamped. And I'd be the first to sit at that table with the governor and say, let's rewrite the tax structure because it's really messed up. It's been jury-rigged with this limitation and that, and I know that there's some fine people who sit on these committees who would agree with that. I can't do that with this particular ballot measure, but I can say this is a priority that needs to be funded. And yes, as the economy grows, we'll probably see a couple of billion dollars in increased revenues next biennium, And I'm okay with of that increase taking $400 million and dedicating it, if that's the figure, to enhancing public safety in the state, which, by the way, will also enhance our economic development because we'll be even more desirable as a place for people to invest and to build their businesses and keep their families here.
Which you can see that the reason why those costs didn't hit the market was estimated is because it wasn't fully implemented. In many instances, the district attorney's deliberate case said, you know, the sentence doesn't fit the crime here, we're going to have to pop this business in and beat it down. Would you concede that that was the case?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shields, I would certainly concede that that was one of the factors. And in fact, as district attorneys got more used to dealing with Measure 11, I think things mellowed out very quickly because it was a new tool. And as with any new tool, sometimes it's not used as subtly as it should be at the beginning. And it is now used much more subtly and appropriately. And that took a little bit of field experience. And so certainly I expect that there'll be less of an implementation time with this because we have plenty of time to contemplate it. In fact, I hope the committee will contemplate what should be done, assuming that this passes, to make changes in the entire system, which is another speech for another day. But there's a lot that needs to be done, and I'm hoping that people will be saying, you know, we better be addressing the drug rehabilitation issue, because if we aren't, some of these folks are going to end up in prison. We're going to have to rehabilitate them in prison, and that's often more expensive than if they're out there in the community still holding a job. So there's a lot of other issues that I'm hoping this will course open.
So in making these mandatory, you're telling the public that if you do this crime, you're going to decide to do a question. The other thing that will happen in this implementation as well is that somebody who commits the definition of this crime will get a new party on the right. So what would it be? Truthful sentencing, mandatory sentencing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shields, it'll be mandatory sentences for those who get convicted of these crimes. I can't guarantee that the police will investigate or the sheriff will investigate. I can't guarantee that the perpetrator will be caught. I can't guarantee what each of the 36 different district attorneys will do. But what I can guarantee is if the jury says you've been convicted of this crime, you will serve this time with the if you have this record.
That makes one last comment. Go ahead, briefly, Mr. Chairman. I guess just a comment now. As chair of the Public Safety Subcommittee, where we had to, one, in the last session, put $300 million more dollars into the Department of Corrections budget because of Measure 11, the property vendor law that was passed in 1996. And as we struggled with things like trying to figure out a way where we could just come up with $1 million to make sure that every high risk inmate leaving prison got some cognitive behavioral therapists. To suggest that we need drug treatment for these folks and we don't know where the $400 million is going to come from, I just feel it's incredibly irresponsible to bring this world down. Senator Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mannix, I'm glad you're out there fighting for truth, justice, and the American way. I don't know what we'd do without you in Oregon. But let me tell you.
I'll accept it at face value.
Yeah. You know, I appreciate what you try to do. We've had conversations in my office on many occasions about things that you try to do for Oregon. But I think Representative Bonamici pointed out that we had a reduction in property crime. And now you're telling us that we need to invest $400 million or $250. We don't know what the cost will be because property crime is off the map and we need to take care of it. Have you ever thought about putting your energies into prevention of crime instead of the treatment of crime afterwards by sticking these folks in prison? There are other issues going on in our society that cause people to do the things that we do. So do you think it would be better spent on preventing the crime before investing this money on just putting them in prison afterwards?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker. Absolutely. In fact, in terms of my legislative record, if anyone wants to go, I served on Ways and Means 2 sessions, and on the Emergency Board 2 sessions. I was among those who were continually saying that we're better off investing in early childhood programs, prevention programs, and for the long term, that makes a world of difference. But I also reminded folks that if you want citizens to support that, you also have to show the citizens that when you have a perpetrator out there in the community who is a predator, that you're willing to hold them accountable. They want to see accountability today as well as long-term results. And yes, it's always a juggling act about how you can best do that. And the message I was trying to carry forward was we don't have enough jugglers on the public safety side, in my view, in terms of the forces at work in the legislative process for whatever reasons. And the initiative process allows the public to have their say about that. And 41, though, is a good example of where 20% of the money in 41, 20% of that chunk of lottery money will go to counties for prevention programs for young children at risk. So I certainly recognize that as a very important.
Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up on this from my last question. For the last 16 years, the legislature has defunded education in the state. It wasn't until the last legislative session that we were able to extend the Head Start program to over 3,000 more children. And we had testimony from the police chief out in Gresham talking about the value of the Head Start program and how there is a connection between children who are disadvantaged and how they can go on and be disadvantaged further and get involved in criminal activity, though I pointed out that not all disadvantaged children get involved in criminal activity, but the information is there, the record is there. So, Mr. Mannix, I suggest to you that if you were to grab $400 million out of the general fund budget, we would be back to defunding Head Start and back to defunding education and doing all the prevention programs that you want to do. So I just want you to think about the consequences of that, which I'm sure you have.
Unless you feel bound to respond, Mr. Mannix, I don't, we have a few other questions that I'd be able to some other witnesses line up, so I think we can move on to that.
I do not feel so bound. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mannix, do you have a projection or an estimate for the savings to the public result from the implementation of Agent 40 and the standpoint of not losing the property, the revolving door of the courts and the sheriffs and the police and so forth, all the other basic cost to the public? And when I'm not talking government costs here, I'm talking about the mom and pop grocery store in the program.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Whitson, roughly speaking, for every dollar, now it depends on how you make your investments, but for every dollar that's expended on pulling these perpetrators off the streets, the public will save more than a dollar. In terms of insurance costs, in terms of damage to citizens, but there's also the emotional cost to our citizenry. And one of my biggest concerns is we seem to forget that these kinds of crimes victimize poor people more than anybody else, and they have the lowest voice among the electorate. When someone steals a poor person's car, they've stolen their transportation. If it's a rich person's Mercedes or even their Toyota, they've got insurance, it's a $250 or $500 deductible, it's an inconvenience, but they're taken care of. You pay for it in cash in terms of insurance premiums. When someone breaks into a poor person's home and steals their stereo or their TV, they stole their entertainment. For a wealthy person who has insurance, it's the deductible. It's a personal assault. It's considered very personal. There is an emotional impact on our community. And I would take you back to the studies. It's called the broken window syndrome in Boston. And what happened in New York with the turnstile jumping approach of Mayor Giuliani. Where you establish in a community that there's going to be a comprehensive accountability system as to violations of the law, you will find that there is not only a reduction of crime across the board, which saves money, but there is also an improvement in the economic activity in that community. And the Boston study was most dramatic about that. So I can't calculate all of it, but I can guarantee you that if this costs $400 million, the benefit to society will exceed that.
Hold on. Thank you. In the five counties that I represent, the circuit court judges have pretty well agreed that about 95% of the crimes against people and about 95% of the crimes against property are drug and alcohol related. And certainly in our neck of the woods, many of our residents are not being concerned about that issue. I think that your plan particularly focus on those that traffic and methamphetamine is inevitable. I do think there's a portion of the plan, a portion missing in that treatment, both in interdiction and in treatment of methamphetamine people. One of the things that was most troubling in our area was seeing kids 11, 12, 13 years old. I've always kind of felt that you got addicted to something that's your own fault, but you know, when they start addicting kids at 10 years old, perhaps reevaluate that. So, could you comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Whitsitt said, I just pulled up a copy of Petition 104, the Oregon Crime Fighting Act. It's not a subject of discussion today. But I'm very sensitive to the need to expand rehabilitation programs in the community. And one of the sections in Petition 104, of which I am the chief petitioner, provides for a tax credit for contributions to rehabilitation programs, drug and alcohol rehabilitation programs. And it's in there because of the felt need to help communities expand their rehab programs. The prevention side is extremely important, and it's in another ballot measure, I hope. Right now it's just a petition. It's not in circulation because it doesn't have the final ballot title, but it is Petition 104, and one of the sections provides for a tax credit for donations to those programs. Now, that's a funding source, I suppose, although tax credit costs us in other ways. So no single ballot measure will be the be-all and end-all and total answer. There's so many other things that need to be done, and I hope that we'll be looking for the holistic response that we can tie together across the board, and I certainly would be happy to work in that process.
Councilor Taylor.
I have a question. You mentioned earlier that unlike Measure 11, there's greater flexibility as it relates to prison facilities and weapons. Yet in Section 2, the person is not good at service, the term of the principal is eligible to be released by the supervision or any form of temporary leave of custody. You mentioned the fact that what can be also be something like Portland, where there could be release that community for work. So my assumption is that that would not be a temporary release from custody, but would be within the meaning of what you figure work camp means.
Mr. Chairman, Council Taylor, in fact, we're trying to derive something else here, and I think you're getting at it. The Department of Corrections has an old-fashioned concept of custody, which isn't quite the ball and chain, but it's, gee, if you're in our custody, you've got to be behind a wall, or you've got to be inside a wall. And the state doesn't want to take responsibility for inmates who may be out in the community unless they've got a corrections officer watching them all the time. I have no problem with us reevaluating what the definition of custody is, as long as the state is ultimately responsible, so long as there's no argument about when the corrections officer says, I need to put this person behind a high wall. You don't need to go through a hearings process. You just say, sorry, it's not working. We're putting you behind a high wall. It's deliberately designed to give us some more flexibility about how we handle some of these inmates.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up briefly.
So, Mr. Mannix, for lack of a better term, let's say the Department of Corrections could have what we used to call a halfway house. And towards the end of the inmate's term, they could put that person in the halfway house. They could go out and work in the community and could come back at numbers. And that would not that would be considered here a work camp.
Mr. Chairman, Council Taylor.
Yes.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you for being here. I guess I'm just going to put a couple things on the record just based on what you said. I think there's a difficult call as to what was happening with violent crime and fire attachment on the demographics and actually showed that there was already a downward trend. Not saying that Measure 11 didn't have an impact, but I don't know if I would say that it stopped violent crime in the state. Demographics and reporting, clearly I believe our state law enforcement has been much diligent in reporting crime compared to maybe other states. And so I'm not sure the number the same year or the worst actually reflects a percentage per capita based on how we make it reporting versus others. But I do want to ask you on Measure 41, since there's no money in there for incarceration actually set forth, stated that the cost of Measure 40 will be through the general fund. And you've also had discussions with citizens about what would be the appropriate incentive. In those discussions with citizens, did you ask them if they're willing to pay for that additional service so they would not see a downturn in funding or in education, other areas of public safety, or human health services?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brzezinski. Short answer is, we always have those discussions. I treat it as more of a rhetorical question in the sense that there's always going to be trade-offs and priority choices that have to be made. When people discuss what they want to see done with certain kind of perpetrators, they want them held accountable, period. And then they're saying, you guys take care of it. That's really the message that the voters have. Now, in terms of the Measure 11 crime rate, though, I need to be specific here. And by the way, my own law firm website has a Measure 11 report that we did after 5 years, which has the old crime statistics, so it's documented there. You can also go to the Crime Victims United website, and they'll show you the crime rate. In Oregon, the violent crime rate from 1958 through 1994 was even or up. It did not go down. We implemented Measure 11 in 1995, and for the next 10 years, Oregon, of the 50 states, had the greatest reduction of violent crime in the United States. And it was not during economic good times for the state. So the economy issue, we had some tough economic times, if you remember what happened with timber. But from 95, for the next 10 years, 44% reduction. Tremendous. So those statistics speak for themselves. Now, I'm not saying Measure 11 was the only thing that did that. But it was the biggest piece of the puzzle.
Lastly, I want to ask you, you said in your presentation that you believe that the state will be receiving, if I got the number correct, $1.2 billion in increased revenue that would actually be able to be used to offset the cost. What basis are you using to determine how much revenue we're anticipating to grow in this next 2 years?
Well, Senator Brzezinski, I guess I should say Chair Brzezinski, the state economic forecasts are out there, and we're warned that we may not grow as fast as we were growing, but I haven't seen a forecast that says that we're not going to continue to grow. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairs, Chairs Brzezinski and McPherson. My name is Craig Prinz, and I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission, and I've been asked to do an evaluation of how many prison beds Initiative 40 would require. Patsy should have handed out a PowerPoint with two slides on each, and I'm going to go through that PowerPoint. I think a lot of this... I have to do to start with a disclaimer, which is this is not the financial impact estimate that will be done for the November ballot book if the signatures are certified and this is on. And what this is a look at is two scenarios of how prosecutors would apply measure initiative 40, excuse me. So the disclaimer is this is a work in progress, and this is a look at two scenarios that we can continue to refine as we move forward. When we get more data, more input from the DAs, they're really the keys to this, and we can get more accurate on it. So I'm on page 2, which says part 1, the initiative. So this is on the November 2008 ballot. It would be applicable to crimes committed on or after January 1, 2009. And I think Mr. Mannix has covered that it is a mandatory minimum for certain drug and property crimes. It does not apply to juveniles. It does not, juvenile adjudications are not factored into it. And one of the keys to my mind of how this will be applied is Section 6 of the initiative. I don't know if you have Section 6 of the initiative, the three sentences there, this is pretty much the basis of one of my scenarios, and the other is history of Measure 11. But Section 6 says that sentences imposed, quote, under this act shall be served in state prison facilities and work camps. The sentences shall not be served in county jails, except as to time served pending trial. And then the state shall reimburse the county as to the actual cost of pretrial incarceration for each person sentenced under this act. That you'll see, I tried to factor that section in to how I would estimate that prosecutors would apply this measure. The next slide in your handout has the mandatory minimums, the way it's set out in Section 2, which is for any dealing or manufacturing of heroin or ecstasy would be 36 months. Dealing or manufacturing cocaine or methamphetamines within 1,000 feet of a school or to a minor would be 36 months, and that's because those are the A felonies. So that's Section 2A. And then Section 2B would be any other dealing or manufacturing of cocaine or methamphetamine. And then ID theft and burglary in the first degree. For those of you, burglary in the first degree is a burglary of a dwelling. It's a home, the way most people think of it. The other crimes that would be subject to the mandatory minimum do require the serious criminal record as it's defined in the measure in Section 3, and that is forgery in the first degree, which would be basically forging $1,000 worth of checks, and prosecutors can, we call it, aggregate that. You can use several checks over a time period to get to the $1,000 to move that to from a misdemeanor to a felony. Motor vehicle theft, for these purposes, I understood Mr. Mannix said that they did not include UUMV and kind of defined motor vehicle theft in the Act in Section 4. For my purposes, we used UUMV. It's the most common that prosecutors use. And I think that with this measure, it would just change the practice and they would use theft the theft under the Act in most cases. I think that wouldn't be a problem. The issue would be, as Mr. Mannix said, we would focus on where you can prove an intent to permanently deprive the person of the car and not the joyriding situation. Theft 1 is, you can see this, that's stealing $750, or that's theft by receiving. There's some other ones that are in there. And then burglary in the second degree basically means burglary of something other than a dwelling or something other than a house. It means typically going into a store or something to steal with an intent to commit a crime inside. So that's the measure as we looked at it. And we developed scenarios of how DAs would apply it using kind of five steps. Step 1 was to look at all the convictions with the computer. Step 1, by the way, is the hardest and most irritating part of trying to figure this out, is asking the computer different questions about all the offenders. this measure. The next slide in your handout has the mandatory minimums, the way it's set out in Section 2, which is for dealing or any dealing or manufacturing of heroin or ecstasy would be 36 months. Dealing or manufacturing cocaine or methamphetamines within 1,000 feet of a school or to a minor would be 36 months, and that's because those are the A felonies. So that's Section 2A. And then Section 2B would be any other dealing or manufacturing of cocaine or methamphetamine. And then ID theft and burglary in the first degree. For those of you, burglary in the first degree is a burglary of a dwelling. It's a home, the way most people think of it. The other crimes that would be subject to the mandatory minimum do require the serious criminal record as it's defined in the measure in Section 3, and that is forgery in the first degree, which would be the basically be forging $1,000 worth of checks, and prosecutors can, we call it aggregate that. You can use several checks over a time period to get to the $1,000 to move that to from a misdemeanor to a felony. Motor vehicle theft for these purposes, I understood Mr. Mannix said that they did not include UUMV and kind of defined motor vehicle theft in the Act in Section 4. For my purposes, we used UUMV. It's the most common that prosecutors use, and I think that with this measure, it would just change the practice, and they would use theft the theft under the Act in most cases. I think that wouldn't be a problem. The issue would be, as Mr. Mannix said, we would focus on where you can prove an intent to permanently deprive the person of the car and not the joyriding situation. Theft one is, you can see this, that's stealing $750, or that's theft by receiving. There's some other ones that are in there. And then burglary in the second degree basically means burglary of something other than a dwelling or something other than a house. It means typically going into a store or something like that to steal with an intent to commit a crime inside. So that's the measure as we looked at it, and what we did is we developed scenarios of how DAs would apply it using kind of five steps. Step one was to look at all the convictions with the computer. Step one, by the way, is the hardest and most irritating part of trying to figure this out, is asking the computer different questions about all the offenders and making sure we have the correct eligible offenders. Step two was to analyze what happens to the offenders now. Then step three, we made a key assumption, I think, that Mr. Mannix and the discussion with the committee, DA practice changes in the light of a mandatory minimum, and that was the conversation about that, and we'll get into that. And we gave two scenarios of how this measure might be applied by prosecutors. Step four was to determine the number of beds there would be changed. How much the change to the current forecast would be, and then step five is apply the costs. So step one, who are the eligible offenders? When we looked at all of the offenders, we used all of those convicted in 2006, and we saw about 4,900 offenders who were convicted of these crimes that we adjusted where they were not. They wouldn't have met the scenario of most serious conviction. We did that by using the grid block. Basically, A through H, would those offenders would qualify as serious criminal offenders. And only this Section I, people that have no felony or no, I think it's no felony or no two misdemeanors, they would not be subject to those for those crimes. So we adjusted for that. We also adjusted for offenders who stay longer in prison than the mandatory minimum, which occurs when a defendant receives consecutive sentences under repeat property offender, or for the burglary, the crime of burglary is high on the grid, so some of those offenders are going to have a higher presumptive presumptive sentence under the grid. So that's step one, who are the eligible offenders. Step two is what happens to them now. So you can see in burglary in the first degree, all Berg 1 convictions are eligible. So in 2006, that would have been 734 offenders. We looked at what happened to them now, and you can see where they, some went to prison, some went to probation. 332 went to prison for an average length of stay at prison of 19 months. 8 went to local jail, and 394 went to probation. The way a person under Berg 1 would be sentenced now would either be under the repeat property offender statute. If they qualified for that, they would get 19 months. And then on the grid, and I don't know if we handed out the grid, we did. Berg 1 is either a 7, 8, or 9, depending on if the dwelling was unoccupied, occupied, or whether there was the use of a weapon or a threat of serious physical injury. So you can see where it would be on the grid, and that's what drives these sentences currently. And so I just put in a couple other, looked at other crimes, what happens now with identity theft, what happens now with theft one, and I put on the bottom of each slide what drives the sentence currently. It would either be the grid or the repeat property offender for these offenders. So we looked at that to determine what happens now. Page 6 of your handout would be step 3, which is how will DAs apply 40? Basically, the bed impact of Initiative 40 is how will the DAs apply it? That's what we've learned from the past, as Mr. Mannix said, from Measure 11. What a mandatory minimum does is it increases the leverage for the DA so that typically what we saw with Measure 11 is you indict for the crime that carries the mandatory minimum, and then in the plea down process or the bargaining process, you offer a lesser included offense that you can plead to. So, for example, you'd indict for Rob 1 and then offer an attempt Rob 1 or a Rob 2 or a Rob 3, and the sentence would then be driven outside of it. It's that bargaining process. That's what we've learned from Measure 11, what happens mandatory minimum. So I'm going to go through two scenarios of how DAs might apply this. The first scenario I call the Rob 2 scenario, because we looked at how Measure 11's Rob 2 was applied, and the other scenario I call the Section 6 scenario, and that would be more driven by Section 6 of the initiative that has that that language about jail reimbursements. Why did we use Rob 2? It's the mandatory minimum crime that is closest in that most Rob 2s are a theft, a property crime, plus force or threatened force. And then to make it a Rob 2, there has to be another person. It would basically be two-on-one robbery or a purported weapon by the defendant, meaning they act like they have a weapon. And so that's why we chose that. There's no actual weapon required to prove a Rob 2. There's no serious physical injury. There's no death. There's no abuse. Those are all the things in the other Measure 11s where you see that in a violent or sexual offense.
Mr. Chair? So, quick question, I apologize. So no weapon is needed in robbery 2?
For Rob 2, it's described as a purported weapon. So it's typically you have your hand in a bag or, you don't have an actual weapon. You purport to.
What's the sentence for that?
70.
70 months.
Yeah, mandatory minimum of 70 months.
Thank you.
Obviously, it's not a perfect comparison. I believe it was the best way we could do to look at it. I talked to the DA's Association. I think they thought it was a reasonable way to look at it. So under the Rob 2 scenario, what we look at is the ratio. We'd be on page 7 now. You look at current practice, the DA indicts for, and then what happens. And we took a ratio from that. So, and by the way, we use this, we use Multnomah County data because it's the best place to get data because of the computers, but we did check this against the state. So here's the ratio we got is in 43% of the cases, the DA indicts for Rob 2 and actually convicts of Rob 2. In another 36% of the cases, the DA indicts for Rob 2, pleads down to something lesser, but the defendant still goes to prison. And basically, it was a 50, basically it took, the ratio is 57% of that 70 months, which is about 40 months, is what the guy gets sentenced for. And then another 21% of the time, the defendant gets a plea bargain where he gets probation or local jail. So that's how we applied this to the drug crimes, the Berg 1, and the identity theft, which carry the 30 or 36 months. For the forgery, the theft, the car theft, and the Berg 2, we just, because that sentence is not long enough, if you used the proportion going to prison, if you used, it would just be 43% go to prison, 57% get probation. Okay, those are the ratios for Rob 2, the Rob 2 scenario. And you can see the impact of that was 4,100 beds. Now that is 4,100 beds by July 1, 2012. That is the full implementation. By that time, we should see as many beds as we're going to need, with the longest sentences being 3 years, a January 09 start, and time to phase in, meaning go from investigation to arrest to prosecution. Section 6 scenario, try to capture how this Section 6 in Initiative 40 is different from Measure 11. This language is not in Measure 11, and I believe it provides an economic incentive to convict, quote, under the Act. And so we tried to estimate how that might change the practice. And so what we did there is a basic 75% of those of the drug crimes, the Berg 1 ID theft, 75% go to prison, 25% go to probation, and then for the lower crimes, those all go with the mandatory minimum. And that way the county receives this reimbursement money for the jail costs. And the other factor we used, we looked at how long offenders stay currently in a repeat property offender. It was an average of 60 days. Now, there's a lot of guys who don't stay at all in jail pre-trial, but for those who do stay, it was an average of 60 days. So under the Section 6 scenario, that's going to drive the prison bed higher to about 6,300 with that same time frame, July 3 years plus phase-in. Table 9, or page 9, shows graphically how this would change the prison forecast. The current, today we have 13,477. The current forecast, which is done by the Office of Economic Analysis, goes to January 2017, and it accounts for about 2,500 beds until January 2017. That graphically shows where the Rob 2 scenario and the Section 6 scenario would take the prison forecast. The reason it's steeper is a lot of these people get probation now. So Measure 11 added length to sentences of people already usually going to prison. This changes the dynamic of who goes to prison, so you'll see a faster impact. Step 5, applying the costs. And this is the part that I am not as much of an expert on, so I used two numbers that basically I borrowed from the legislature. The first is I used, for the prison cost, I used $77.78 per prison bed per day. And that is the adopted number for the 07-09 legislature for DOC. This would be a discussion point. It's probably not accurate for this scale of growth. That's what, in the legislature, when I'm testifying about the prison bed impact and it's like 100 beds, 80 beds, this is the same number I use for that discussion. It does not. It's an operating cost. It does not include the construction cost, the capital or the debt service. It does not include, for lack of a better word, how much you'd have to, the administrative costs if you had to increase the statewide administration, meaning you'd have more institutions, et cetera. And also for the jail bed cost, I used a recent jail bed survey. This would be for Section 6, meaning how much would the counties be reimbursed. I used $105 per bed per day, and that's based upon a jail survey. And so you can see the cost estimates under Rob 2 would be the reimbursement amount from the state to the counties for the jails would be about $19 million per biennium, and that would be fully implemented. That would be by July 2012. And then the $256 million would be per biennium, and that would include the jail cost and the prison cost. The Section 6 scenario, you can see the reimbursement is larger. And again, that was that scenario where more are going to get the mandatory minimum because of that economic incentive to the county. And the prison plus jail cost per biennium fully implemented would be about $400 million.
Thank you. Mr. Prince, have you factored in the cost to hire more DAs and more staff? Is that including the reimbursement to counties? Or just $19.2 million for jails, just as jail staying how much that costs?
And Chairs and Senator Walker, this was, I did not. This is going to bear, I think there's a, what does actual cost of pretrial incarceration mean? Well, we just went with the best number I had for actual. This is the number that DOC uses, it's my understanding, and to reimburse counties currently under the Community Corrections Plan, I believe. So that, I just used that number from that. I just used that number, the best I had. But it does not include anything other than jail costs, and I think Nathan Allen and Doug Wilson would be a lot better to answer that question.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that question. Senior DA's been on the way to all the work.
No, I see your question. This is only for the jail costs, not for prosecution or anything like that.
So there are extra costs here that we're not talking about in addition to these direct costs, correct?
Correct. Yes. And Senator Walker, all I'm saying is I'm probably not, you know, I'm good at trying to figure out, I hope I'm good, I'm trying to figure out how many people, the issues of, you know, costs, I think others would be better at.
I'll speak to that. You are good.
Okay. And then,
thank you. I just
yeah,
wanted to get the
yeah.
cost on the table so we're all yeah. part of the stuff.
Yeah, and that's, I think, a big discussion area that I, you know, probably not the best to do. Next steps, last page, to keep working on with this. The Office of Economic Analysis, I have not had a chance to really work with them very much because Sue Porter's been finishing the October OYA and corrections forecast. So in the months upcoming, as we move toward, you know, when we'd have to put the fiscal estimate on this, we can work with them. And we continue the dialogue with the prosecutors and other key criminal justice decision makers on these issues like Senator Walker's brought up. So I'd be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Are there questions for Mr. Prinz? Lieutenant Shield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Prinz, you were Multnomah County District Attorney, is that correct?
Representative Shields as Deputy District Attorney under Mr. Schrum. He's not here. Okay, good. I was a Deputy DA here in Portland.
Good answer. Did you do many identity theft cases when you were Deputy?
I did a lot of identity theft cases. I did robbery cases and a lot of these types of crimes.
Do you have any sense of what the gender of most of the identity theft perpetrators were and whether or not many of them, if not most, had drug addiction problems?
Chairs and Representative Shields, good question. I know that, I don't have the gender specifically, but I do know that with the meth epidemic that we really saw in the last 5 or 6 years, I know that Coffee Creek saw, a 2 or 3-fold increase in the number of female inmates, and I know that those are mostly identity thieves. So identity theft is a crime where most crimes are more male. Identity theft, you have a lot more females. And I think, well, you probably have seen that for those of you done the prison tours. You know, that's the female inmates at Coffee Creek. That's why that expansion occurred.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, maybe we can ask Ms. Volunteer that question too when she comes.
Very good, Lucy. Any further questions to Mr. Prince? Hearing none, then Mr. Prince, thank you very much. My next call forward is Joan Palmatier from the Department of Corrections.
Good afternoon, Representative McPherson, Senator Pozanski, and the Joint Judiciary Committee. My name is Joan Palmatier, and I am the Population Management Administrator with the Department of Corrections. The Office of Population Management manages actually new prison construction, inmate classification, special needs beds such as ADA, high-risk behavior inmates. We also have, community development, which goes with new construction, and we're heavy into that, as you might understand. I provided the committee with a copy of the recent DOC long-range construction plan letter from Director Williams to the Governor and the Department of Administrative Services Director. The projection, without the consideration of Measure 40, was to build Junction City facility in Junction City. Nothing in Measure 40 changes the projection, still requiring Junction City to meet those forecast demands. And that's based on the April forecast, and we have not completed the numbers on the October forecast thus far. I want to thank you for allowing me to speak today, and I've prepared a few statements regarding the housing should Measure 40 go forward. And then I'd be happy to answer your questions. You requested that we appear today to discuss how we would house those inmates convicted under proposed Measure 40. As Mr. Prince stated, state prisons would be required to house thousands of additional male and female inmates over the next 3 years. Those offenders will look very similar to the current inmate population that we have housed in Department of Corrections today. And when I say that, the reality is many of them will have mental health issues, serious mental health issues, certainly medical and dental needs given their propensity to use methamphetamine and other drugs in the course of conviction of their crimes. Based on the security challenges that we face, the conduct and the inmate needs that we have within our department and we will continue to have, a portion of those inmates will be eligible for minimum security housing. However, not all will be eligible to be housed in minimum security housing. Based on their mental health needs, some of their medical needs, the type of nursing and mental health treatment availability that we have in our minimums or do not have in our minimums, so many will be eligible for minimums, some will not. If Measure 40 passes, the department will consider a variety of options to house the inmates convicted under that measure. Some of those options that we have considered are expediting the opening of Deer Ridge facility to reach the maximum occupancy sooner than we've expected, determining whether we can further expedite the construction and the opening of Junction City facility. To the extent allowable, utilizing available county jail beds and possible out-of-state beds, be those public beds or be those beds operated by private prison operations. Fast-tracking the construction of White City, which is the only DOC available site that we have not developed thus far, and that's been set back a minimum of 10 years. Constructing additional prison facilities at current DOC locations such as Madras, Deer Ridge, Umatilla, Two Rivers Correctional Institution, and we have some DOC Salem property that is still available. Consider some of the camp and camp light expansions. Excuse me, and this one always gets me. Camp light facilities. We do forest fighting, and we work with forestry. We have a huge cooperative agreement with state and federal lands, and we have Deschutes National Forest, where we have a camp the majority of the summer that is open, and now for a short period of time in the fall when the weather was good. Thank you, and I'll take questions if you have those.
Other questions? Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Chair. This is probably not your area because I don't know that you were involved in this last round where the Department of Corrections had to make some small cuts in their budget. But if Measure 40 passes, it's going to create a huge budget shortfall. And the Department of Corrections itself, just like education and health care, will be called upon to make reductions, substantial reductions in its existing operations. It's a major budget item. Has there been any discussion within the department of what areas the Department of Corrections would cut to ante up their share of what Measure 40 would cost?
I can speak to the fact that we are strategizing and developing housing options, what type of staffing it would take, what kind of treatment it would take to house and treat and sustain the basic needs for those type of offenders that come in under Measure 40. We are not at the point in plan where I can tell you any of that. I apologize.
And I apologize for asking the wrong person, basically, but you're the one who's here.
Senator Walker.
Let me ask you a question. When you're thinking, you're struggling to find housing for all these people, so they're going to have some program cuts, not the affordability program, but some rehabilitation programs, and those of you who are offered the inmates. We hope are good citizens when they come back.
Yeah. Sorry, Kathy. We hope, you know, these inmates are prepared to come back into society because I think 95% of them do. So it would be expected that you may have to cut some of those internal programs just to pay for the housing of all these inmates. Would that be true?
Are you, Senator Walker, co-chairs, is it my understanding that you're speaking of cutting programs of the existing population, or if Measure 40 passes, that population, or both?
Well, I think it'd be both. I think you're going to have to cut some things across the board in order to facilitate these extra inmates. And I think that's what Senator Burdick was asking you. And my concern is that we're trying to get these folks back out into the community to be good citizens and prepared to be back out in the community. And if we have to cut back these programs within the prison system itself, they're going to come back out the same way they went in, which is not in a good position for us.
Senator Walker, that's a difficult question to answer, but I will answer it this way. There are realities. From the legislative session in this biennium, we received funds, so we can expand some of our transitional services and some of the things to provide a more positive and productive reentry for those inmates, especially property offenders who will likely go out and raise our recidivism rate, reoffend, and re-victimize. I suspect the same would be for Measure 40. However, that has to play out. Our main concern right now, before we even think about what we'd have to cut and where the budget would come from, is where would we house those inmates? What would that look like? And can we give them the treatment and the existing population the treatment according to mental health and substance abuse needs that they really are going to require? And I believe you have in front of you some graphs related to our mental health profile that we have within the department now, as well as substance abuse profile. And as you see, the demographics, when you look at the substance abuse related profile and needs of the inmates, it's very, very high. We are at 27%. Excuse me. We are at 74% of our existing population today requires substantial substance abuse treatment. And we are working very diligently on our classification system, our treatment, transition, mental health, and substance abuse modalities, because we do recognize that warehousing and punishment is not the answer for these folks, because they will likely, and it has been proven that they go out and reoffend and re-victimize. So the dollar and the budget cuts and those kinds of things will have to be considered, and our department will consider those. But first and foremost, where will we put them? What will that look like? And it's one of our top priorities to strategize as we move forward very soon.
And, Ms. Scheer, my last question, because you're exactly right, Ms. Palmateer, where will you put them? My guess is the department is going to have to look at contracting with other states to ship inmates out of state, because we aren't going to be able to build prisons fast enough to hold all these folks, are we?
There are a number of considerations that we will look at if we... Building, no. I mean, there are a number of things. As I said, you can look out of state. Rental beds in jails, for example.
Right, because 95% of them do. So it would be expected that you may have to cut some of those internal programs just to pay for the housing of all these inmates. Is that true?
Are you, Senator Walker, co-chair, are you... Is it my understanding that you're speaking of cutting programs of the existing population, or if Measure 40 passes, that population, or both?
Well, I think it can be both. I think you're going to have to cut some things across the board in order to facilitate these extra inmates. And I think that's what Senator Burdick was asking you. And my concern is that we're trying to get these folks back out into the community to be good citizens and prepared to be back out in the community. And if we have to cut back these programs within the prison system itself, they're going to come back out the same way they went in, which is not in a good position for us.
Senator Walker, that's a difficult question to answer, but I will answer it this way. There are realities. From the legislative session in this biennium, we received funds so we can expand some of our transitional services and some of the things to provide a more positive and productive reentry for those inmates, especially property offenders who will likely go out and raise our recidivism rate, reoffend, and re-victimize. I suspect the same would be for Measure 40, however that has to play out. Our main concern right now, before we even think about what we have to cut and where the budget would come from, is where would we house that, house those inmates? What would that look like? And can we give them the treatment and the existing population the treatment according to mental health and substance abuse needs that they really are going to require? And I believe you have in front of you some graphs related to our mental health profile that we have within the department now, as well as substance abuse profile. And as you see, the demographics, when you look at the substance abuse related profile and needs of the inmates, it's very, very high. We are at 27%. Excuse me. We are at 74% of our existing population today requires substantial substance abuse treatment. And we are working very diligently on our classification system, our treatment, transition, mental health, and substance abuse modalities, because we do recognize that warehousing and punishment is not the answer for these folks, because they then will likely, and it has been proven that they go out and reoffend and re-victimize. So the dollar and the budget cuts and those kinds of things will have to be considered, and our department will consider those. But first and foremost, where will we put them? What will that look like? And it's one of our top priorities to strategize as we move forward very soon.
And, Mr. Chair, my last question, because you're exactly right, Mr. Palmateer, where will you put them? My guess is the department is going to have to look at contracting with other states to ship inmates out of state, because we aren't going to be able to build prison staff and load all these folks for a month.
There are a number of considerations that we will look at if we... Building? No. I mean, there are a number of things. As I said, you can look out of state. Rental beds in jails, for example, within the Oregon area right now, we are very limited in terms of beds that are available to rent, and we're probably looking at approximately 70 beds. There may be some other beds available in Multnomah County with some modification that could house that type of offender. We're still looking at those options. However, housing in a modest state would very likely be an option. And there are, I would tell you that from my work around the United States and going to other prison systems, there are few, if any, public beds available out there in the state or federal system, because most states are like us and will look to other places to house. California, for example, now is looking and advertising for available beds in the United States. Private prisons is an option. However, we have House Bill 2803, which does not allow private prisons at this time. It will be repealed, I believe, in December of 2009. So until that time, that is not an option for us.
Thank you.
I'd like to follow up on that. I was going to ask you the question. It's my understanding currently do not allow Oregon to go out to private prisons. Is that correct?
That is right. There is a House bill that prohibits that. It sunsets in December of 2009.
Right. And the other question I would like to follow up on is the camp-like facility. Can you tell us how many inmates are actually are in position in those facilities? And then also, when the weather does turn bad, when it's not appropriate to change the facilities, where do those inmates go?
Those inmates come from within our existing institutions to go to the forest camp, which houses approximately 121 inmates at any time. It is typical military tent-type structures, and they come back to the existing facility into one of our beds at, when the weather turns bad. We only use that forest camp for a month, month and a half during the fall season when the weather is good to help create and do some of the burn to get the lands ready for the next spring and the next summer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, for the committee information, last time we sent inmates out of state to private facilities in Arizona, three property offender women were raped. So we think the department will move on that route. And it costs us millions of dollars as well. But Ms. Palmateer used to run Coffee Creek Correctional Facility as the superintendent. Could you comment first on the gender issue that I asked Mr. Prince? And then also, if you could talk a little bit about the risk principle, high risk versus low risk, where do you get the best bang for the buck for your incarceration dollar? And in your experience, would a first-time identity theft offender be high risk or low risk?
Representative Shields, I'm going to try and remember each question that you ask me. You may have to help me if I forget. At Coffee Creek Correctional Institution as a superintendent, and having had the experience of being the superintendent of the Oregon State Penitentiary and the men prior to that position, I can tell you that the females, typically, there are many more, and I don't have the exact numbers with me, that are sentenced for identity theft directly related to methamphetamine use. The treatment modalities that we have incorporated to assist the men and the women have been, we believe, very, very helpful and have led a number of the women that are released from that facility to be successful on the outside, because the treatment modality allows them an opportunity to really get away from using those drugs, whether it's methamphetamine, whether it's alcohol or whatever it is, they can return to their families, they can be more productive, and they generally obtain jobs again. And our, I'd have to look at the numbers. I would just tell you this. From what we saw and what we lived with when we interviewed females that did recidivate, the majority of them had not gone through or had an opportunity to attend a substance abuse treatment program. And their crime, ID theft, burglary, was directly related to their continued methamphetamine use. And there are many more females incarcerated percentage-wise for ID theft than there are males. Your second question.
Was, could you just talk a little bit about the risk rates for low risk versus high risk for the hospital for your incarceration felon? And the first one, then with that was better with that low risk for felons.
The first time identity theft offender could be high risk or low risk. And we base that on a number of things at the intake and the assessment process that we do. There may be other things in their background. There may be other crimes in their background. There may be a violence predictor that's present. There may be mental health predictors that are present. All of those things will compile into one snapshot of what that inmate profile looks like and what their classification will be. Some may turn out to be higher risk. Some may turn out to be lower risk. Their classification will determine where they are housed. Mental health and substance abuse have a lot to do with where we put them. The mental health typically are housed in our higher custody facilities, such as our mediums throughout the state. Those that don't have mental health needs are typically housed in the minimum facilities if they meet other criteria. One of the reasons that the minimums are so helpful for these folks, and if they're doing a shorter sentence, that we do try and get them in to a minimum facility right after intake, if they qualify, is they need to be there for the treatment, for the transition, for the ability to work them their way out into the community again, having the counties come into and work with our caseworkers and with the inmates does provide them a better opportunity to go out when they reenter the community and not re-victimize and not re-offend. Without the treatment, I believe it's a more difficult process.
Just one last quick one. What do you think the ideal amount of time to be able to
Senator Representative Shields, the average treatment for substance abuse is 9 months to 18 months. It depends on the type of program that we have available in our minimums.
No further questions. Senator Bissett, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. Ms. Palmateer, we know that most of these major 40 crimes are alcohol and drug related. Very high percentage of methamphetamine related. Do you have an opinion whether meth addicts, the families, and the communities are better off than the meth addicts in the general population or whether the meth addicts in the state high school?
It's difficult to offer an opinion on that. The Department of Corrections does what we're mandated to do. If we're mandated to take that type of offense, our job is to figure out how we're going to house them, where, how much it's going to cost, if we will have treatment modalities available. And I will tell you that the Department of Corrections does believe that substance abuse treatment, if they are incarcerated with us, is essential if they are a substance abuser, especially methamphetamine, because it's a very difficult drug to treat. They benefit from that. We believe that without that, recidivism can be higher, that it does actually reduce the chance of those offenders to recidivate. short of having the treatment, it's very difficult for us to project and say what they will be like when they come outside.
The question actually is a pretty good segue to our next panel, who are the judges who are going to talk to deal with these populations. So that's my point. Is there something you need to take up now, Council Chair?
Sure, I just have a point to make, and that is the Act itself seems to include the use of private prison sentences imposed on this action to serve the state prison facilities and what.
If there are no further questions, then Ms. Palmateer, why don't we excuse her?
Just better with it, to follow up. Ms. Palmateer, I understand that I probably asked a difficult question, but if we're talking about the inmates who have proper treatment are much less likely to recidivate, we know that those who don't, are not arrested, are not incarcerated, and do not get the treatment, aren't going to recidivate, they're just never going to stop.
That
was the point of the question. Do you believe that it is better to be able to take these people off of the street for themselves, their families, and the community? Is it better to take them off the street and put them in a facility where they must be treated and have an opportunity to return to the workforce and to the population as normal human beings?
Whether it is in the general population in the public or whether they are incarcerated with us in the Department of Corrections or a county jail or wherever it is, or a halfway house, what we know about substance abusers is they need treatment.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Palmateer. We're now like to invite a panel of judges. We're honored to have Judge Sealander, Judge Bergstrom, Judge Maurer, and Judge Marcus with us, and I'd like to have them all four come up together, and if we could add a couple of chairs there, chair, and ask them to share the microphone, and I'll let them, the judges, let you allocate kind of order and a lot of the time. We are on toward about 45. We do need to, don't need to conclude this panel by 3 o'clock in target. We do need to conclude the entire work on this information meeting promptly at 4 o'clock. So we'll be looking to hold this to no more than half an hour on this discussion and questions.
Chair, my name is Bob Sealander. I'm a circuit court judge in Clackamas County. In 2000, I began a drug court. In 2002, I began a mental health court. And for those of you that have no background, and I can't believe there's anybody that doesn't have a background on drug courts, they were started for the simple reason that what we were doing to fight drugs is not working. The war on drugs, putting people in prison for longer and longer and longer, is not solving the problem. And so a judge in Dade County, Florida, tried something different. It became drug court. There is a premise to everybody that comes into drug court, and that premise is that but for the drugs, they would not be committing the crimes. If we didn't believe that, then there wouldn't be much purpose in drug courts. So with that background, let me give you some statistics out of Clackamas County. And I'd like to point out that every county is different in drugs. We're a primarily meth county, heavy meth population. Multnomah County, I think, has more of a mix with cocaine and heroin and meth. Washington County has a different mix, but we're primarily meth. Of the people in my drug court, the average age of first use is 12. 50% of the people in my drug court would qualify under the measure of 40 requirements. That is, there would be property crime, repeat offenders, and be under a mandatory sentence. And just as a rough estimate, and this is harder to grasp because it's hard to get a good statistic on, but I would guess that 80% or more of every property crime committed in Clackamas County, and I'm going to talk primarily about identity theft, some of the thefts of property crimes, are people who are on drugs and specifically on meth. And I say with absolute confidence that of the identity theft, 80% of the offenders our meth offenders. Let me go back to my first statement about simply incarcerating. I never understood why drug court worked, because we do what every other program does. We try and get people off drugs, and we get people off drugs. We started listening to what AA and NA have been saying for a long time, and that is there are seven principal triggers to drug users: people, places, and things, angry, hungry, lonely, tired, poor emotions, people, places, and things. The one thing we can do successfully in drug court is change the people, places, and things. If you don't change environment, if you don't change friends, you're not going to change the drug usage. I wondered why you could put somebody in the penitentiary for 5 years, or 10 years, or 15 years. Oregon, incidentally, has two of the best drug treatment programs in the United States in the penitentiaries, in Coffee Creek and Powder River. And that adjective, the best, doesn't come from me. That comes from people that are involved in drugs, that have been involved in the program, and have come into contact with me. The one thing that penitentiary lacks, I think, for courts have, is our ability to control the people, places, and things. We do it in the community, while they're in the community. We tell people who they can associate with, who they can't associate with, where they can't go, and what they can't do. And it's that second part of it, I think, that makes the court successful. I want to be very careful, because it's not my purpose to comment on any ballot measure or any proposed legislation, and I think it's improper for me to do so. But when Mr. Maddox was talking, he was talking about the broken window response and the turnstile jumping response, and said when you have a quick response to crime, that you can end it. Neither the broken window experiment nor the turnstile jumping experiment, as far as I know, dealt with people who were on drugs like we're talking about, property crimes, particularly the identity theft people. Because the history in Clackamas County is simply treating them like criminals and not doing anything else wasn't solving the problem. The other thing I'd like to underline is 22% of the people on our program have serious mental illnesses. You don't know, mental illnesses along with the other problems you're not going to do. I will turn it over to someone else.
Hi, I'm Jean Maurer, and I'm a judge in Multnomah County, and I would echo everything that Judge Sealander says, although I do not run a drug court. Certainly, I preside over a great many cases in which individuals have been accused of property crimes. I was formerly in the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, and I actually ran the property crimes unit for a period of time. That unit in that particular office doesn't include burglary in the first degree, but it includes many other property crimes. And with the uptick in methamphetamine use, as well as other drugs, the increase in the property crimes has been, of course, profound, and I know all of you are wrestling with that. When I see people in court, I would say that when I talk to them in a judicial settlement conference, which I do frequently, what I learn is that oftentimes they were productive people. They began to experiment with a drug, particularly when it's methamphetamine, and it literally takes over their lives, as you know. And, of course, what I try to do, and I think the other judges here to an extent do that as well. Judge Bergstrom on the end here is somebody who does a lot of the same work I do, is to attempt a what I call carrot and stick approach. I will oftentimes have people come before me. I incarcerate them immediately with release to an inpatient treatment bed if that is what is recommended. When I receive information about that offender that suggests that immediate incarceration is important, sometimes I don't do that and I leave them out in the community and in a treatment program where they are having to manage the addiction in the context in which they are living. And I too am not commenting. In fact, I haven't read the proposed ballot measure, but I am giving you the experiences that I see. I also do regular for the proceedings dates, and I have the offenders come back before me. And I think that there is some benefit to a direct contact, follow-up contact with the judge. And so that is the experience that I have on a daily basis, I would say. And I thank you for letting me speak. And I don't know if there are any questions or if...
Let's hear from all the panel.
Okay. Thank you, Chair McPherson.
I'm Judge Eric Bertram in Multnomah County, and I don't have any prepared remarks. I too, would echo what both Judge Sealander and Judge Maurer said. I was a deputy district attorney as well in Multnomah County for 15 years before coming onto the bench. In fact, I worked for Judge Maurer in the property crimes unit when I came up through the ranks of the office. I will say, I'm sure Gene will agree with me, that the property crimes unit at that time is not like the property crimes unit now at the district attorney's office. The property crimes unit now is probably double in size and quadruple in caseload. And that has a direct correlation with, I think, the meth explosion. And both as a prosecutor and as a judge, those things just go hand in hand. And I do a lot of, as judicial settlement conferences, and speak to a lot of offenders to work out whatever sentence they're going to have with the prosecution. And it is the rare property crimes case that does not have a drug component. And it's rarer now that it's not a meth component. Although I'll say that video poker hasn't helped either. It's certainly a big component. I've tried a lot of property crimes too, and you put meth and video poker together and you have a disaster on your hands. But I do a lot of what Gene does with carrot and stick. Some people, really need to go to prison because for those people, you can just guarantee they're not going to commit a crime during that time. But other people, far more benefit from treatment. That's going to keep them from coming back. Some people are always going to come back, but there are a lot of people that aren't going to come back if they get treatment. That's been my experience.
I'm Michael Marcus. I'm a circuit judge. I've been a trial judge since 1990, and my prior experience was not the district attorney's office, but 20 years in legal aid service, so saw a lot of the same people from the other angle. I agree with everything that's been said here. Of course, drug treatment is a major answer to a major portion of the people addressed. The measure actually does, in very rough terms, identify the group which is really the hardest for us to deal with in terms of success, in terms of preventing recidivism. But my perspective on this is a little different, and that is that the real problem with all of this is that the approach of the criminal justice system is not evidence-based, it's something else. So we keep coming at it with band-aids which respond to its deficits in performance without really accomplishing any benefit. And a mandatory minimum approach, just like our previous ones, does in fact solve a small portion of the problem for some of the people that fit its contours, but it misses the major point. The major point is different things work on different people. The major point is until and unless our sentencing guidelines are based on what is most likely to work on which offender to reduce crime, we are just shooting ourselves in the foot over and over again. We're not going to solve the problem with broad brush approaches to what is essentially a diagnostic and response program problem, which ought to include incarceration for some, treatment for others, and rigorous measurement of those things that work on which people to make sure we're sending the right people to things that will work on them. That could be prison, it could be treatment, or something else, all within the limits of proportionality. Until we do that, we're going to continue to do this business of ineffective performance of sentencing and corrections, not because of we aren't doing the best efforts without information and without guidance, but with guidance and information, we do a lot better. Until we do a better job in allocating our resources according to where they're most needed and most likely to work, we will continue to reap the benefits or the results of basically blind sentencing. The guidelines are not designed to protect people against repeated crime. Senate Bill 919 out of 2005 recognized that by suggesting that the Criminal Justice Commission explore the guidelines to see if they might actually encourage sentencing that reduce crime, which they don't now. The commission adopted some rules. They were before the last session. The bill didn't get anywhere. I understand that the commission is going to work some more in that direction. But the real problem is we need to aim criminal justice and sentencing behaviors explicitly at best practices to produce the results we're supposed to be producing. Until we do that, we can't get there. Questions?
Mr. Chair, Judge Selander, you said, this caught my attention, you said that 50% of the people that you deal with in your drug court would be covered by this Measure 40. And I know you can't comment on an initiative, but could you give us a sense of what kind of success you have in your drug court with this category of people who are now in your drug court who would be under the mandatory sentence, and give us a sense of what your success rate is for these people, and give us a sense of what it costs to get somebody through your drug court.
Chairman, Senator Burdick, let me answer your last question first. We're someplace between 2,500 and 5,000 to go through the drug court program. We started out as a one-year program. We extended it to an 18-month program. I know people tell people coming in it's a five-year program. If they get out sooner than that, then they've really done well. And it's a five-year program because we want to see the change in people. If we don't see the change in people, we don't let them out. When we extended the length of the program, when nobody had an expectation of being out in 18 months, simply fulfilling some requirements and checking some boxes, our success rate went up dramatically. And I think we're somewhere around 75% non-recidivism rate. It's interesting when you talk about recidivism because the measure is whether they've been arrested for anything after they get out of drug court. That's a difficult measure because what you really want to measure is whether they've been arrested or tried or convicted of some of the same offenses they went in on, not whether they have a driving while suspended offense, although any offense is bad, so I'll accept the arrest. But we're about 75% success, and I expect that's going to hold on these people. I also have to point out that for the first 6 months, people were spending a lot of time in and out of custody. We don't accept failure, and we don't accept excuses. And so if there's a problem, there's going to be a consequence to it. And I think on many of these people, it takes 6 months before they begin trusting us and believe we really want to help them. And then there's something magic. And that's the only one that's funny. It happens in about 6 months. And then it's a matter of them really getting involved in the program and working hard to change.
And the cost.
The cost is someplace between $2,500 and $5,000.
For what period of time? For the whole 5 years? For what period of time does that cost?
For the average person going through our drug court. I've only had two people, I think, in there for 5 years. So I think we're someplace between 18 and 24 months. And we're about $2,500 a year, so we're about $5,000 for 2 years.
As opposed to 25 to get somebody through your drug court.
Chairman, Senator Burdick, let me answer your last question first. We're someplace between $2,500 and $5,000 to go through the drug court program. We started out as a one-year program. We extended it to an 18-month program. I know people tell people coming in it's a five-year program. If they get out sooner than that, then they've really done well. And it's a five-year program because we want to see the change in people. If we don't see the change in people, we don't let them out. When we extended the length of the program, when nobody had an expectation of being out in 18 months, of simply fulfilling some requirements and checking some boxes, our success rate went up dramatically. And I think we're somewhere around 75% non-recidivism rate. It's interesting when you talk about recidivism because the measure is whether they've been arrested for anything after they get out of drug court. It's a difficult measure because what you really want to measure is whether they've been arrested or tried or convicted of some of the same offenses they went in on, not whether they have a driving while suspended offense, although any offense is bad, so I'll accept the arrest. But we're about 75% success, and I expect that to point a hold on these people. I also have to point out that in the first 6 months, people are spending a lot of time in and out of custody. We don't accept failure and we don't accept excuses, and so if there's a problem, there's going to be a consequence to it. And I think on many of these people, it takes 6 months before they begin trusting us and we really want to help them. And then there's something magic, and that's the only way I can explain it. It happens at about 6 months. And then it's a matter of them really getting involved in the program and working hard to change.
And the cost?
Well, the cost is someplace between $2,500 and $5,000.
For what period of time? For the whole 5 years? For what period of time does that cost?
For the average person going through our drug court. So I've only had two people, I think, in there for 5 years. So I think we're someplace between 18 and 24 months. And we're about $2,500 a year, so we're about $5,000 for 2 years.
As opposed to $25,000 to $30,000 for a prison debt. That's my comment.
Yeah, it's hard to answer your question. Everybody in drug court has to have a high school diploma or a GED. We send them up to Clackamas Community College, and that's where they get their GED. That's not an added cost to us, so we're not adding that cost in. We've tied in with Community Solutions in Clackamas County and Voc Rehab to get people trained for jobs and then to get them jobs. That's not an added cost for us. And so if you add in a proportional cost, it still would be considerably less than $30,000, but it would be more than probably the $2,500 I'm talking about.
Thank you. And it's just an observation. It just seems unfortunate, to say the least, that this measure would, in effect, be diverting people out of a program that works into a program where the recidivism rate is much, much higher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't want to come up to this kind of verdict. I'm thinking along the same lines today. How many of you find that you don't have enough treatment room available? You're all going to raise your hand. And so when you can't get them in the drug court program, they fall into the prison system, I assume, they have to go somewhere. Is that correct?
Chair and Senator Walker, I wanted to say that what I tend to do is to, if I think the person can be managed in the community, I hold them in jail until a bed is available. That varies in length of stay depending on the availability of those drug treatment beds. Sometimes it's about 45 days to 60 days, something like that. Other times, if the person is not a person that appears to be a risk to reoffend, I can have them remain in the community where they might be employed, because if I take that away, that can sometimes destroy the one anchor that they have. And have them go to NA every day, or sometimes come back and see me every week until they get into that treatment bed. If they are a person that has a lengthy record and they simply belong in prison and or clearly aren't amenable to treatment and they don't convince me that they are a good risk to be released, then I will send them to prison, of course. And then they would be treated there if there is a lengthy enough sentence for them to get into the prison program.
So this is an effective program when it works, because we see people in the community who can still work
they recover and everything falls well, it ends well, but the ballot measure is more of a one size fits all from what I'm hearing. One of your comments is, you know, if you violate the law, you're going to put in for amendment.
Well, as I say, I haven't read the ballot measure, but I will say that oftentimes when I structure a sentence, it is with an eye toward the future potential failure. And so I will make an agreement with the offender that if the offender is not serious about the statements that the offender is making to me, then there will be a back-end period of time that is longer than the period of time that is on the table, if you will. And that way I can ensure that if the person is going into the prison system because of a failure, they will be there long enough to get the treatment.
Absolutely. The reintegration question is very much the same as the probation question at the lower end. First of all, you need the resources, and for most offenders, the more resources you have, the more likely you are to be successful. The measure of success, in my view, has got to be recidivism in one flavor or another, because that's what we're here for. The reality is we don't have enough resources in prison or on probation. We've had programs that we've lost that used to do very well. The problem is that most of the resources are allocated in a way that has nothing to do with accountability or success. They're allocated on another basis altogether, and we nibble around the edges in what we can garner in terms of probation resources before or instead of prison. And treatment in prison is always in competition with the hard costs and the personnel costs and reintegration resources, and what the Department of Corrections always has to do, and often correctly, is reserve treatment for the people who are the highest risk. The result is, one of the statistics, and I think Representative Shields was asking about this, for low and medium risk offenders, according to the Department of Corrections classifications, with the exception of some species of sex offenders, low and medium risk offenders are going to increase their recidivism if you use incarceration on them. High-risk offenders are going to keep basically the same rate of recidivism. That's assuming the same level of services that continues. We need to be allocating, first of all, we need the whole system to recognize it, that it's what works that matters, because that, in the long run, is how you get the resources to where they belong. If we allocate them on some basis other than what works, then, of course, we're wasting a lot of money. I'm trying to use your time well. One of the things we learned in the group that resulted from Senate Bill 919, Paul Bilotti, who was a researcher with the Department of Corrections, kept crunching numbers and gathering numbers that we didn't have access to before. The guidelines, according to validated risk assessment, that is risk assessment derived from the experience that we actually have with offenders in the system over a period of time. If you compare the guidelines with the data, you find that the guidelines for the most important cohort provide a sentence which is too long for a third of them, too short for a third of them, and a right about one time out of three. That's the way we're allocating our prison dollars. They're in competition with our treatment dollars. And if we send the right people to what works, we should be able to do a much better job than we're doing, but absolutely reintegration resources are critical to most offenders. On the other hand, we need to make it clear to everybody that not everything works on the same people. You've got to do what works on the people it works on, and then prioritize that, because frankly there are some drug abusers who will be better offenders if we solve their abuse problem. And that's a fact of life. Most offenders improve their behavior from our point of view when you adequately address the drug problem.
I need to follow up on one of the questions. Our system has really changed from the days in the past where you used to have someone coming in and giving recommendations to the board as to what type of service, where you had much more discretion and at the time of the time. In your best world, what is it that you can do to make sure that you have that person for the percentage that you are able sectional out who they are, what more than likely is this place to put them to give the biggest bang for the buck for cutting down on the
I've got an article coming out that shows my approach to the whole question. It's called the harm-based sentencing code, harm-reduction-based sentencing code. It'll be out in a couple of months. In my best world, first of all, you enable with legislation the constitutional provision that the first purpose of sentencing is protection of society. We have the guidelines that don't address that, and the Constitution that says that's what we're supposed to do. I would require that the whole process be focused on best practices, on the best evidence available for what is most likely to work on which offender within the limits of proportionality. There's a lot of ways to do that. You can build it into plea bargaining. You can build it into the performance measure of the courts. You can build it into the requirements for a sentencing order so that you make the findings. You can build it into the probation officer's obligation to the court in making a report. And we've moved a lot in that direction. Those few sentencing recommendations we get in pre-sentence investigations now address as a matter of law what is most likely to work on this offender if it involves programs in or out of custody. Tell us if the offender is actually going to get in those programs. And that's a step in the right direction. There are a lot of things we need to do, but basically making this an evidence-based process with the kind of responsibility you'd expect of someone who is practicing any other social science, any other social activity, could be a sea change in what we're up to. The drug courts are wonderful. They're an exception that proved the rule. It's a tiny percentage of the people we process get into drug courts. The rest of them either don't qualify for drug courts or are on their way to prison. And the efforts that we make to try to get the right things to the right people, which may be treatment and may be custody, are completely obscured by the overall paradigm of the guidelines, which is, here's the box, that's what you do.
Mr. Chair, it's hard to disagree with Michael, he's always so particular. I think one of the things I've learned is we tend to jump to the bottom line too soon. So when we started our drug court, we wanted serious offenders in drug court. A lot of people that don't initially come to drug court, most people go on probation. If they are on probation and they're having a problem with drugs, we now have probation referring to our drug court. If our drug court out of the system means is not working, we put in into an inpatient treatment program, and we have a substance use program, which is a semi-lockdown program. And we just keep ratcheting up what we do until we run out. But we're not running out on most people. Something's working along the way. I think it's a mistake. Maybe Michael can come up with a measures on it, but I think it's a mistake because we have an imperfect system and we're dealing with imperfect people to say at the onset, this is what we should do with most people.
Further questions then, judges, thank you very much for coming and presenting to us today, and thank you for the passion and energy that you bring to dealing with this population of social problems.
Thank you.
We'll now move on to the second component of our information meeting, and I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Brzozowski for
thank you. our second portion is funding of initiatives, possible statutory or constitutional provisions that will address problems associated with initiative-driven financial obligations imposed on the state, how these obligations should be met. For all the members here, I did ask Senator Morrison to please come up and join us today. He's graciously willing to do so. I know that he will share with us some of the work that he and other members have been working on as to how this has impacted us. So let's start off with that, and then we'll move into a couple other presenters. Okay, Senator.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Colleagues and Chair McPherson, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. For the record, Frank Morse, State Senator representing the Albany-Corvallis areas. What is being handed out to you is data. There's four pieces of data that we have used in our revenue restructuring discussions with Oregon. Senators Decker, Schrader, Weston, and myself have spent considerable time going across the state within our districts talking about revenue restructuring. And the data that you're looking at has to do with the impacts of initiatives on spending in the state over the past 15 or 16 years. And you really can't have a discussion about the spending picture in Oregon without having a reflection on initiatives and their impacts on spending. What I might add is the four slides that you can see there, slides 5 and 6 and 12 and 13, and they're out of this presentation that I was referencing. This data has been provided through our Legislative Revenue Office and our Legislative Fiscal Office. And you can see that since 1990, approximately 50% of new spending in our state has been determined directly through what probably would be appropriately called direct democracy. And that is a fairly significant number, increased spending of $3.4 billion out of a total increase of $7 billion. And the slide shows you where that spending has occurred, measures 5 and 50, $3 billion, measure 11, $184 million, measure 66, $145, and measure 99, approximately $39 million. Then if you look at spending on a per capita basis, what you'll see is that, and I want to point out also that these slides have not been updated for the 07-09 budget period, ending with 07. But what you'll see is that spending adjusted for inflation and initiatives has actually declined on a per-person basis from 1989 to 91 biennium of $1,625 per person to the 05-07 biennium of $1,583. And of course, that would be adjusted upward because of our increased revenue for the 07-09 budget period. But you can get the picture is that initiatives have had a huge impact on the spending patterns in our state since 1990, since the advent and the implementation of Measure 5. A very, very significant impact. And what we chose to do is to address how this initiative process has influenced two of our key spending areas, and that they just happen to be in education, K-12, and higher education. And what you'll see is that when you adjust for inflation and the growth in student population, that we have, through the period of 05-06, that school year, you'll see that spending actually declined 11%. And, of course, we've had some correction, and we brought that back. But the impact has been significant, and we all know that. We felt it, particularly as we dealt with the budget shortfalls in the 03 and 05 sessions. There may be some debate with respect to actual ADM, average daily membership population, versus the special education students. But I would suggest that when you talk to educators, these special education students have increased, and I don't think it's just a matter of choosing to reclassify ADM students into special ed students. They really have had a huge bearing on our system. So when you look at that that data, we have had a reduction in funding for K through 12 through that time period. Then if you look at higher education, you'll see an even more dramatic impact. And we have had over that time period, from 91 to 07, we've had a reduction on an inflation student basis, adjusted 36% for higher education. And of course, the university system has made up for that by charging fees, and so they've met the cost by transferring more costs to the students through fees and assessments. So the direct democracy does have its expense. There's no avoiding that. And any discussion about revenue, and if we're looking at the initiative process, we have to look at the fiscal impacts, and those fiscal impacts have been real. We've listened to the fiscal impacts projected, not yet defined for Measure 40, but it will factor in much the same way. The last sheet is something that I have proposed for discussion purposes. Direct democracy, is it good for Oregon? Well, there are a lot of opinions with respect to that issue. But the fact of the matter is, it is here. It's sacred in this state. It's time-honored. And so I think it's incumbent upon us that we look, how do we make it better? How do we improve the system so that voters can make more informed choices? When initiatives have significant fiscal impacts, under our current system, can they make informed decisions, particularly when it's cast in a vacuum? Is budgeting by initiative good policy, or is it an oxymoron? Bill Lunch has addressed that in the Willamette Law Review. I thought it was a pretty good article. But budgeting does imply that if a choice is made to spend money on something new, it necessarily follows that something old will be reduced, or you raise additional revenue. Now, if you go back and look at the history of this state and the $3.4 billion that have been shifted to the general fund, discretionary, lottery, and general fund sources, there's no new revenue, other than we just happened to catch the tidal wave of an economic expansion that covered that nut. And then it fell apart in 2002, when we all remember in that fiscal year, $2.4 billion of revenue that was forecasted literally disappeared. So there are choices to be made. How do voters make informed choices about something that is potentially as significant as Measure 40? The emotion says yes, lock them up. But we then, in our role in the legislature, have to balance that. Should voters have the opportunity to balance that information as well? And I think that's a very real and valid discussion and question to pose. And if you look at our process, you look at representative government versus direct democracy, and contrast the two in terms of how we budget. Our budget process requires, in its a guideline, that any measure that has a fiscal impact of $50,000 or greater has a referral to Ways and Means. Well, there's a reason for that. The cynics among us say, well, that's a black hole and it's a place to bury bills. But the functional aspect of that is you can't craft a budget without knowing what the rest of the budget is as well, and then weighing those priorities. And as imperfect as our system is, it does work. Contrast that to direct democracy, and you don't have that benefit, because if voters choose to spend, in the case of Measure 5, if that were to come along at this time in our history, and to transfer $3 billion of spending to the general fund and lottery fund, how would they make an informed decision with respect to that? What I would suggest in terms of consideration and discussion here, in terms of alternatives, the right of initiative is so sacred in this state. To change that or change the terms and the conditions, I think, would be fraught with all kinds of problems. But there may be some ideas that could be generated for the purpose of making an informed electorate so that they can make choices. They are, in fact, if voters will be voting on Measure 40, they will be making a budget choice because there are no new revenues in the pipeline for that measure. How can they make an informed choice? Well, a thought would be that for any initiative with fiscal impacts greater than X, whatever that may be, that it then be referred to the legislature for analysis, not to change the initiative, that language stands, but to enact a companion measure that implements reductions elsewhere in the budget if the initiative is approved. So people would have an informed choice, knowing that this spending new is going to be affecting the rest of the budget in this way. That may be a way of providing better information to the voters. And of course, the legislature may choose not to make reductions in existing programs, but to allocate new revenues that are expected. That's always a possibility as well. We really need to bring fiscal discipline to the initiative process, but yet preserve the rights of voters to exercise that will. So I appreciate the opportunity to share with you, thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Questions for Senator Morris? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Morris, is any of these bills and are there any things that you've been advised on those bills?
No. This latter concept here, we had some thoughts in last session that we talked about in the Senate, but they didn't get legs. One of was it was a SJR that would have required an initiative once it garners the necessary signatures, that the first step would be to the legislature to review, and then we collectively in each chamber would pass a vote, an advisory vote. So my district would know how I would vote on Measure 40. And then that would be put in the voter's pamphlet as a means of informing the voters in a more detailed way that's truly representative of our state, not just the Fiscal Impact Committee that maybe, you know, people would have questions about whether that's truly objective or not objective. That did not receive, support to continue. But I think what we're seeing is another example of, that this Measure 40, in the eyes of the public, is probably going to be, it'll find great favor. People are fed up. with the offenses. But how do they make the choice of taking that new spending and comparing it to the other needs that we have? Because we don't have unlimited resources.
Reverend Shields, I've actually have had some discussions regarding this. I wanted Senator Morris to be here to kind of give the perspective of what they've worked on. It seems to me that we as voters, or voters, have to have some accountability that we are being held to as elected officials and even in our families as to how we do our family budgets and bills and payment, what services we're going to subscribe to or not. And so one of the thoughts is that possibly once a citizen initiative does pass, then we in the legislature would have an obligation to come up with some type of package for providing for that service, new service or additional service.
How can they make an informed choice? Well, a thought would be that for any initiative with fiscal impacts greater than X, whatever that may be, that it then be referred to the legislature for analysis, not to change the initiative, that language stands, but to enact a companion measure that implements reductions elsewhere in the budget if the initiative is approved. So people would have an informed choice, knowing that this spending new is going to be affecting the rest of the budget in this way. That may be a way of providing better information to the voters. And of course, the legislature may choose not to make reductions in existing programs, but to allocate new revenues that are expected. That's always the possibility as well. We really need to bring fiscal discipline to the initiative process, but yet preserve the rights of voters to exercise that will. So I appreciate the opportunity to share with you, thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Questions for Senator Morris? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Morris, has any of these bills been, are any of these ideas been devised in bill form or LC form?
No. This latter concept here, we had some thoughts in last session that we talked about in the Senate, but they didn't get legs. It was a SJR that would have required an initiative once it garners the necessary signatures, that the first step would be to the legislature to review. And then we collectively in each chamber would pass a vote, an advisory vote. So my district would know how I would vote on Measure 40. And then that would be put in the voter's pamphlet as a means of informing the voters in a more detailed way that's truly representative of our state, not just the Fiscal Impact Committee that may be, you know, people would have questions about whether that's truly objective or not objective. That did not receive, you know, support to continue. But I think what we're seeing is another example of, you know, that this Measure 40, in the eyes of the public, is probably going to be, it'll find great favor. You know, people are fed up with the offenses. But how do they make the choice of taking that new spending and comparing it to the other needs that we have? Because we don't have unlimited resources.
Reverend Shields, I've actually have had some discussions regarding this. I wanted Senator Morris to be here to kind of give the perspective of what they've worked on. It seems to me that we as voters, as Oregonians, have to have some accountability as we are being held to as elected officials and even in our own families as to how we do our family budgets and bills and payments, what services we're going to subscribe to or not. And so one of the thoughts is that
possibly once a citizen initiative does pass, then we, the legislature, would have an obligation to come up with some type of package for providing for that service, new service or additional service, and then it could be done, as Senator Moore says, by either offsetting other expenditures and or a combination of new revenue. That would then basically allow that implementation of that that measure. Remember, we had a ballot measure 30, which was a referendum to the voters on the funding structure that was put together, I think, in 2003, that when it went down, we basically lost a lot of funding that went to various types of programs. So under this concept that I'm, let's say, somewhat floating, is that if we were successful, which would be required to do, of coming up with some type of package for implementing that citizen passed initiative, and if it should the funding source be referendum and go down, then we'd have to have another discussion as to what other source of funding would we have to actually implement that. And that's the part that I feel from my tenure as a legislator of seeing how questions are asked at the poll as to, do you want this to be done? But no one ever asked the question, how are we going to pay for it, or what are we going to do without? The sense of balancing education needs, public safety in other areas, or human services. Other questions or comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank I just want to thank Senator Morse. I always appreciate your vision, and you've got some great ideas here. I'm a little bit nervous about allowing the public to cut programs because they don't have the benefit of everyone coming into the legislature and talking about their program and how valuable it is, which is what sort of your scenario would entail, that if you're going to, if you don't provide a new funding source and tell us what you want to cut, that makes me a little nervous. But I like the path you're going, and you're right, the initiative is a centuries old initiative. 1902, we were the first state in the nation to have an initiative process, and I don't think Oregonians or you or I or any of us really want to get rid of it. We just need to make it more in line with the 21st century, and how can we meet all these needs? And we heard earlier today what Mr. Annex wants to do. And while it's great at the doorstep in terms of, yeah, we want to put all these people in prison, in reality, what have you done? I think you've interrupted the treatment program, the treatment process. I think you've added a lot of expense that we don't have in the budget, and as Senator Burdick pointed out, we don't have a tax structure that can support that. So I just want to say thank you, and we're going to continue to work on it. At least, I don't know, I'm very interested.
Well, thank you. If I may just elaborate just a little bit on this strange concept, would be, let's assume, for example, that the operating cost plus the capital cost is $600 million per biennium. That initiative would, in the future, you wouldn't have time to influence it now, but in the future, that initiative would come to the legislature before the voters enact it. With that impact of $600 million, then you go through the hearing process and you say, okay, these are the alternatives. We might fund $300 million with new revenue, but $300 million has to come out of existing programs. And then you make that disclosure as a guidance document from the legislature saying, this is how we will manage it. Then that's the companion piece with the initiative measure that voters have the opportunity to decide, knowing that, you know, whatever the reductions may be, will be a part of the consideration to add something new. This whole idea of direct democracy doing budget work is fraught with tremendous risks. How do we make an informed electorate? Because I trust them. I think we all do trust the electorate if they have the information. Thank you.
Thank you. Margie Easton.
Chair Posansky and Chair McPherson. For the record, my name is Marge Easley, and I'm president of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. We greatly thank you for the opportunity to address the issue of initiatives that are adopted by the voters, require general fund expenditures, but provide no revenue source. The League of Women Voters of Oregon has long supported direct democracy through our initiative process. But initiatives requiring state resources can cause significant problems as they create competition among state programs for limited tax dollars. We have mentioned several of those examples, and following Senator Morse, he's said a lot of the things that I am going to say as well. Classic case in point, public education costs resulting from the passage of Measure 5 in 1990. Without any new revenue source, the initiative capped K-12 school funding from local property taxes at $5 per $1,000 of assessed value, placing the burden on the state to make up the difference in money needed to educate Oregon's children. At the time of passage, the general fund provided about 29% of the cost of public elementary and secondary education, with local property taxes and other funds making up the difference. The state now covers more than 60% of local school costs. And in the meantime, the state's population has grown significantly, and the general fund is consistently pinched, trying to cover education, human services, public safety, and transportation. Another key example, Measure 11, passed in 1994. Mandatory sentences took away judicial discretion and added a prison population not eligible for parole. With no new revenue source specified, Measure 11 caused a doubling of the prison population, with a need for prison construction to house the growing population. In analyzing this increase, as well as the cost effectiveness of mandatory sentencing in general, the League believes that we must take politics out of the equation and examine carefully the findings recorded in the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission's report to the 2007 legislature. This excellent report was written to help policymakers understand the costs and benefits of our current criminal justice plan, with the goal being to punish criminals and reduce crime. And according to the report, during the past 20 years, state general fund dollars spent per household on criminal justice have increased by more than 79%. The Department of Corrections, which operates the prisons, cost taxpayers $1,130 per household in the past biennium. Has this been the best use of tax dollars? While violent crime in Oregon has fallen by 45% since 1995, statistics indicate that a 10% increase in Oregon's incarceration rate has led to only a 2.6% decline in the crime rate. Further analysis shows that while it was most cost-effective to incarcerate violent offenders, it breaks even for property criminals and does not pay to incarcerate drug offenders. The League believes that sentencing policy should be based on data and analysis as provided in this report. Now, for the first time in several sessions, the 2007 legislature passed a comprehensive revision of the initiative process, addressing several issues that have clouded its use in the past. We believe that now is the time to seriously consider what to do about initiatives calling for state spending without funding sources. And the League has several suggestions. These are just suggestions. First, and these are in no order of our wish list, but a return to voters with funding options identified of any initiative that requires general fund expenditures. Secondly, a requirement that an initiative without a funding source not be allowed to move forward. Thirdly, and this may be our preference, use of an indirect initiative process for unfunded initiatives, which would refer the initiative to the next session of the legislature.
The initiative could either be passed outright or sent to the voters with the funding source specified. And not on this list, but there's always the possibility that an alternative initiative could be proposed by the legislature with a specified funding source. The League urges you to move the discussion of this issue forward, and we look forward to participating in it, and we thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Yes.
Thank you. I just have a brief comment. It would seem to be part of the reason of the initiative
Representative Barker, I think that's an excellent idea, and that is the idea of our second suggestion there, not being allowed to move forward or requiring it, making it a requirement of initiatives.
Other questions or comments? You need to have a microphone. Senator Wester, go ahead.
Thank you. Just a rhetorical question. I wonder if you considered if the people of Oregon are satisfied with how they prioritize how we're spending the funds. At least they continue to bring initiatives forward and pass them, knowing that they have put a significant amount of stress on other areas. I'm wondering, do we know better than they, or do they know better than us?
Any other thoughts or comments?
I did want to say that I have attended some of the hearings that have been held out in the communities when the budgeting occurs, and it's a very, very difficult process for all of you, I know, to hear all of the needs of the communities in the various areas of the state. And it is in effect that there is great competition for these dollars. And some of the stories you hear and some of the people that come and some of the people that didn't even get to speak because they were at the end of the list. And it goes on and on and on. And so it is a process that is a very, very difficult one. And to have unfunded initiatives makes it that much more difficult.
Thank you. Our last invited guest for this portion of the informational meeting is going to be Doug Wilson from the Legislative Fiscal Office. Doug, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Co-Chair, for the record, Doug Wilson, lead analyst for public safety for the Legislative Fiscal Office. We're here mainly as a resource to answer any questions today, but I did prepare some sort of issues or challenges to the type of thing that Senator Morse and the Lee-Wynn voters talked about, just to keep in the back of your head. It unfortunately adds difficulty into sort of trying to budget or trying to come up with a revenue source when it comes to ballot measures. Significant ballot measures, ballot measure 11, ballot measure 5, whatever that might be, do provide a significant challenge to legislators in coming up with the budget process. That challenge in the short term is probably no greater than a lot of other challenges you have faced in setting priority budgets, whether it's revenue shortfalls, 2001-03 budget or biennium, changes in caseloads in DHS, which can be significant, or changes in federal policies. But in terms of some of the factors you should keep in the back of your head while thinking about this issue is, first of all, these aren't in a vacuum. If you take a look at Measure 11 or Measure 5, and I think someone mentioned this already, the full impact of Measure 5 was tempered, at least in the first biennium, by a pretty healthy economy. So the impact would have been much worse if there hadn't been a significantly growing economy. ballot measure 11, short term, it did not have a large impact. Keep in mind that this lengthened sentences. It did not put folks into prison that weren't there before. They were going to be there before on the most part. The impact, even though it's roughly 4,000, a little less than 4,000 beds today, it took until the year 2000, based on Office of Economic Analysis figures, it took until the year 2000 to get to a 1,000 bed impact to the prison system. Other have significant impact. Ballot Measure 48 from the 2006 election would have limited growth in state expenditures based on population and inflation. That would have had a significant impact. It would have been just a revenue shortfall, much like you faced in 2001-03 biennium. The timing, impact of the phase-in of the measure must be taken into account. Ballot Measure 11, as I mentioned, took until year 2000 to reach 1,000-bed impact. Now, the Mannix proposal that was discussed earlier today will have an immediate impact. In fact, if passed in a year from now, it will have an impact in the current biennium, which will have to be addressed early on, likely in the 2009 session. I'm sure I get the sessions right here. Who controls the decision-making? Ballot Measure 99 in the year 2000 was created the Home Care Commission. I believe the explanatory statement at that time, the financial explanatory statement, only included information regarding the cost of the commission itself. The true cost of that commission really was what happens in many years out to the wages of home care workers in part. And those were decisions made through the budget process in large part as it affects those in-home care workers funded through a state system in some way. Ballot Measure 37, again, the state has only reacted by those administrative costs for state government. I don't know how the legislature would have gone through this process and taken a look at what if they were to try to estimate how much they may be willing to pay out. So, again, another uncertainty. Difficulty in estimating the impact of a measure. Some are short-term in nature, much easier. Some are long-term. But regardless of the fact, you do have both in short and smaller measures and long-term or larger measures changes in the impact over time. Ballot Measure 56 in 1998, required landowner notification for certain local zoning law changes. The legislature, through the emergency board, soon after the passage, set aside a little over $500,000 for that particular measure in terms of reimbursing local governments. Very little of that money was spent, and in the next biennium, even though it was funded at a lesser amount, expenditures were still less than that. Again, ballot measure 11, big impact, no doubt, but it took time for us to learn what that impact would be. There's great uncertainty in that. Someone else was making decisions, much like the Mannix proposal. It was a lot of it up to the DAs. If the growth in the prison population based on Measure 11 had been to the original forecasts, we would have been operating two more prisons today, I believe. White City and Junction City would probably be up and running as originally planned. Again, the uncertainty is what's driving that, and it's hard to do the forecasting that far out. And finally, there's both direct and indirect impacts. Home Care Commission, for example, the direct impacts of the cost of the Home Care Commission, the indirect, much harder to gauge, was the cost to state government that may have occurred because of that the bargaining and representation issues out of that ballot measure. And finally, the process, you do have some tools available to you to do the immediate impact. You have the emergency board, not a very large emergency fund that has never really reached much more than $30 million in the discretionary emergency fund. But you also have now a rainy day fund available, and you would have to work through on how you use that in funding any initiatives if that took place. So with that, those are just cautionary comments to keep in the back of your mind. In a perfect world, a process that we were able to do, as Senator Morse suggests, or something along those lines, would be great. but in practice, it's going to be difficult to get there.
Thank you. Questions or for Mr. Wilson or any comments?
Just a general comment as listening here, Dan. I think it's of note that it's really interesting today that we're talking about how the voters put mandates on us as legislators and how we're reacting to it. It's just an interesting parallel as I'm sitting here. I just thought about the mandates that we put on voters and private individuals and their businesses and how they react to it. Something to think about.
Other questions, comments? Mr. Wilson, thank you very much for joining us today. And
Mr. Taylor, I think that concludes what we on the Senate side need to take care of.
That's correct. But the House has some housekeeping business to do.
So at this point, I'm going to first, before I close the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary, ask members and Senator Morris if there's anything else we need to take care of today before we gavel out. Not seeing anyone jumping up. The Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary will close its portion of the meeting today, and we will be meeting at the call of the chairs. I believe we're going to be trying to have another meeting before November 15th.
That's correct.
November 15th, for all members, remember, is the date that we have to have something to LC if we're doing any proposed legislation, and I think that's some of the stuff y'all are going to be taking up on the House side right now. So the senators will be trying to figure out a date between now and the middle of November to have our second meeting. With that, we will conclude our portion of the meeting at this time.
House committee members, we remain in session, and as indicated in the agenda, the purpose of this portion of the meeting is to discuss process. It's not we have handed out to you a memorandum that we produced for the request of the speaker recently, describing the laundry list of potential issues for consideration during this interim, and the speaker's office has presented to the chairs and the committees the proposed procedure for bringing bills forward to the supplemental session in February. And the process that's been described is that there will be no member-introduced bills for the supplemental session. Each of the committees formed for the interim will have one bill that it can bring forward for the supplemental session, and there will be a very small number of potentially other bills that the that are identified by the speaker's office as being of outside of that, or in addition to that one bill per committee. So we need to be thinking about what the one committee bill is that we would bring forward to February. And the urging from the Speaker's office is that it, to the extent that at all possible, that we that be a consensus bill, something that would draw broad support within the committee and on the House floor. So without trying to introduce, just trying to go through the issues that are identified on this memo, this is just a compilation of ideas that have been presented to me and to the staff of the Judiciary Committee as potential ideas for the interim generally, not necessarily for the February supplemental session. We will be meeting, as Senator Przonski has indicated an intention to his committee, to meet once more before the middle of November, and the reason for that timing is so that a drafting request can be made for whatever issue we identify as being that which we would expect to introduce as a committee bill. And so I urge the members, if there are other ideas beyond the ones that are on this list here that you think are of such urgency, and would sufficiently likely to draw consensus support, people should be bringing those forward and presenting them to me or the vice chairs, Mr. Barker, Mr. Wisnett, or the staff, or all of the above, here soon because we need to be moving toward a sort of a narrowing down process. Or just off of my own perspective, I think that the issues surrounding Measure 40 are compelling issues that could have an impact on the state, if not anticipated, if there is an appropriate anticipatory kind of action that you would want to take. So I would suggest that might be what we would want to do. But I want to have a little discussion here about process, not about the substance of any of these bills. It's in for us.
I think, Mr. Chair, one possible question really, can you say that it should be a bill that would be of a consensus nature from the committee? Are you talking about a unanimous vote or a majority party vote?
I think the consensus would be drawing broad support across the committee. I think it would be a great concern to me and to the Speaker's office if we had a bill that was the one committee bill that came forward on a party line vote. I think that would be unfortunate.
Thank you.
We haven't set the date of that meeting, but obviously there's not a lot of days between now and the middle of November. So do be thinking ahead about how your calendar is shaping up, because we're going to be trying to find a meeting time before November 15, or before November 15, to do that, hold that meeting. So be thinking ahead, and I would say as soon, if, to the extent that there are issues that are not on this list that you think ought to be considered for the February supplemental session, and I'd say as soon as those can be brought forward, that would be all given a greater chance to be considered. And then we'll try to focus that further meeting on trying to narrow this down, but that would be the reason for choosing the subject matter that was presented today is that these are issues that would seem likely to be appropriate for early action. So I wanted to get it out in front of the committee to sort of consider that as a potential approach.
As far as I know, the single
legislature
is going to
This is an inclusive list, a whole range of ideas have been presented to me. Impact on the state, if not anticipated, if there is an appropriate anticipatory action that we would want to take. So I would suggest that might be what we would want to do. But I want to have a little discussion here about process, not about the substance of any of these bills. Of course.
Consensus nature from the committee. Are you talking about a unanimous vote or a majority party vote?
I think the consensus would be drawing broad support across the committee. Great concern to me and to the office if we had a bill for what is the bill that came forward on a party line vote. Unfortunately. We haven't set the date of that meeting, but obviously there's a lot of days between now and November. So do be thinking ahead about how your calendar is shaping up, because we're going to be trying to find a meeting time before November 15th. And I would say as soon, to the extent that there are issues that are not on this list that we ought to consider for the federal legislative session, as soon as those can be brought forward, that would be all given a greater chance to consider. And try to focus the that further view on trying to narrow this down, but the reason for choosing the subject matter that was presented today is that these are issues that seem likely to be appropriate for the reaction this is an inclusive list, a whole range of ideas have been presented to me by people that they'd like to have discussed at some point in the interim. And do recognize that we will be doing work over the end of the interim, but it's not for the supplemental session, because that's the work that has been historically is to prepare for the next regular session. So most of the issues that are on here, if they are forward or are considered, will be in preparation for the January 2009 regular session. It's really, the aim is to address budgetary issues and a very small number of policy issues in February that are ones that are not appropriate. February session is an experiment, I think, on everybody's part. So just how our time will be handled or managed during that session, I think, is we're all going to find out. And it's a regular session. All of us here, really all of us, it's one day special session. But several weeks supplemental session of your experience. So that would be my hope that we could consider other issues, because there we are at the Capitol, and why not do as much as we can do as we can to come together not issues that are need other questions or comments about those matters. And hearing none, that concludes the work of the House Judiciary Committee for October the 11th. We're adjourned.